You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Delta Quadrant Podcast, part of the Trekmate Family.
You're listening to The Delta Quadrant, a Star Trek Voyager podcast. This is a podcast where we review episodes of Star Trek Voyager in the order in which they were broadcast. But not today, because today we end the movie retrospectives with Star Trek Nemesis. This is Mark from England.
And this is Matt from Arizona.
And this is Gino in Oklahoma.
And Gino's been waiting a long time for this podcast, but I think he might regret it by the end of this episode.
I got the gloves on, guys. Let's make this happen.
You got the gloves, but I got the material. And don't worry, folks. For those few fans of my snark, the snark is coming heavy this episode.
And for those few fans of Star Trek Nemesis, I will do my best to defend this amazing movie.
Yes, all five of you who think that this is the best movie ever will have Gino on their side. The rest of the sane world, just wait.
And I'll do my best to try and be a little bit balanced. I'll try my best.
But you know what? We want to welcome you back, Mark. You've been on for the last three movie specials. You are our special guest.
I am the special guest for movies.
So in case people have been living under a rock and haven't listened to either Trekmate or any of the movie specials that you've been on, just tell them a little bit about yourself and where you normally appear within the Trekmate universe.
Okay, so I'm 39 years old. I grew up watching the original series on TV on the BBC. But when TNG started here in the UK back in 1990, we got TNG quite a bit later than you guys. That was when I really fell in love with Star Trek. And from that point on, I never looked back. So I've watched every series, watched all of the movies, always been a big fan. And I started podcasting almost to the day about 2 years ago, when I joined the Trekmate show as a guest. So you can find me on the Trekmate show, which you can find on our website at trekmatefamily.com, and you can often find me here on the Delta Quadrant. I also guest fairly regularly, two or three times per season on previously in the Alpha Quadrant as well. So you'll find me everywhere on the Trekmate network.
You're sort of the podcasting mistress of the Trekmate Network.
Or the podcasting whore, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to be polite, but before we get into our discussion on Star Trek Nemesis, as we have tried to do with all these movie specials, we're going to talk about first experiences with this movie, whether that be in theater or otherwise. And for me, I did see this one in theaters. Like I said, to my great misfortune, I saw every TNG movie but First Contact in theaters. So I do remember this came out in December of 2002. I was on holiday from school for the Christmas season, and I went with a friend of mine who was also big into Star Trek and saw this in a theater with four other people. Not a very heavily packed audience, and bear in mind, when I first saw this movie, I did really like it, but I was also 14 years old, where my litmus test for a good Star Trek movie is, did it have cool battles? And yeah, this one had a battle, all right, and at 14 I thought it was cool. We'll see if it holds up now at 24. But that was my first experience with Nemesis. So Mark, what about you?
Well, this was released, I think, in the UK probably early 2003. Now, that was right about the time my daughter was born. And I didn't see this in theatres, and I wasn't watching a lot of Star Trek at the time. Now, I'll admit, I didn't actually watch this movie in its entirety until about 2 years ago. I'd watch bits of it. I knew they'd killed off Data. Sorry, spoiler alert. I knew they'd killed off Data, and that upset me. So it took me until around about 2 years ago before I finally watched this movie all of the way through. So I would have watched it at home on DVD.
Okay, that's cool. And actually, that's really cool because it's you managed to avoid it for 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
9 years. But, Gino, I'm dying to hear what your experience was.
I didn't see this movie in the theater. This we're talking Christmas season 2002. So, I would have been in high school at the time. I was probably busy with some kind of rehearsal or one thing or another, but at the time, I wasn't as involved in the Star Trek world as I am now. That said, I saw this movie for the first time. My brother and I actually watched it together, and both of us had the same visceral reactions to all the amazing shots and the wonderfully built story. So when we first experienced this movie changed things for me. Don't give me a look, Mark. I see you. This changed the face of Star Trek for me, because when it comes down to it, this is the most recent Star Trek movie with the next-gen cast. You know, so this is the last time we get to see them. This is at technology's best that we've seen them acting. And that made me fall in love with the movie. And that, and seeing them in the DS9 uniforms and the Enterprise-E is always just a wonderful sight. Blah, 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 blah.
All those things are in First Contact. I just want to point that out.
Okay.
But, got well-built story.
Yeah.
I'll get into that. And in fact, I, before this show, had an interview with Larry Nemechek. And he also explained how the writer himself, it's Logan, really knew what he was doing. And he knew what he was talking about, and he's an actual Star Trek fan. The problem that this movie will admittedly had was directing. And that's because you got a director who didn't know Star Trek, and that hurt the entire movie.
No, you know what? I want to make a distinction right up front, because there have been Star Trek directors in past and present, because I count J.J. Abrams among this, who aren't fans of Star Trek. Nicholas Meyer was the same way when he directed Star Trek II, had not seen Star Trek, didn't know anything about Star Trek. The difference being between those two people who made brilliant films and this guy who never directed again after Nemesis is that Stuart Baird not only didn't know Star Trek, he didn't give two damns about Star Trek.
Something you also run into there is when you're talking Star Trek II, that's the second Star Trek movie that was ever made. When you talk about J.J. Abrams, he was reinventing a universe. Stuart Baird came in to an established franchise. You've got all this canon from the TNG crew, and though they talked about making another movie afterwards, they decided during filming that this was going to be the last one. Mm-hmm. So he's your last best hope. And for somebody who doesn't know the canon coming into it, that's where you have the problem.
No, well, I'm sorry. I mean, we could say that all he wants, but it doesn't matter. If you don't respect the material, it's going to show.
And oh, absolutely. Does not respect the material. I'm not going to disagree there at all. He had no respect for the material. However, this is a situation, and Larry mentioned this in our interview, where your crew and your cast know so much about it that they pull together and rise it above what it may have been, but it doesn't get to the point that it could have been.
Well, I think that's up for debate. My problem with this movie extends far beyond the direction, and unfortunately for John Logan, who I do like because he's gone on to make some brilliant films, including Skyfall, which I just loved. I think this is a classic example of why you don't have fans of Star Trek write Star Trek. Personally, but we'll get into that as we go on. So I'm going to go over the short synopsis for Nemesis, and we're going to go jump right into the notes. Before I read the short synopsis, I want to do a little experiment with you, and this highlights some of the problems I have with this movie.
Okay.
So I'm going to read you a plot line that I've constructed myself.
Feel you trying to entrap me here, so listeners, be wary.
A somewhat twisted man who is sentenced to live in a desolate place with hardships and losing people he loves, all of a sudden get the ability to leave the planet on a ship and get a hold of a doomsday weapon, which they will personally use to fulfill their personal grudge against the captain of the Enterprise. By the end of the movie, the ships are fighting in a nebula battle that's extended. At which point, the second most important character on the series gives up their life and stops the Doomsday Weapon and kills the bad guy. Now, am I talking about Wrath of Khan or am I talking about Nemesis?
I was going to say that sounds really cool. That sounds just like Wrath of Khan.
There are insane parallels between the two, yes. Yeah. And there are parallels between this movie and Star Trek III.
No, I would say more Star Trek VI. But, yeah, parallels is being nice. People who, in my opinion, people who kept referring to Inner Darkness as a ripoff of Wrath of Khan need to watch this movie. This is a pure out-and-out ripoff of Wrath of Khan. And one of the biggest problems that I have with this film.
Okay. I could see that, and I'll agree with that. It, you know, runs along right side. They're different movies, but you've got a very similar premise. So I won't argue with you there.
But anyway, I just wanted to try that little experiment because, you know, when something like that, people might not consider something like that, so when you spell it out for them like that, it may make things interesting. But anyway, the real synopsis of Star Trek Nemesis is Captain Jean-Luc Picard and the crew of the starship Enterprise E become involved with the Romulan Empire's new leader, Praetor Shinzon. When the Romulan's new Empire's new leader, Praetor Shinzon, makes overtures for peace with the Federation. Surprisingly, Shinzon is not from Romulus, but from Remus, a native of the darkness-shrouded twin world of Romulus. But he is not even a normal Reman at that. Picard faces a new, very personal enemy, and the Enterprise E is tasked with preventing a costly reignition of war between the Empire and the Federation. That doesn't even sound like what happened in this movie, but we'll get into it. This movie was released in the U.S. at least on the 13th of December 2002. Screenplay by John Logan. Story by, well, I'm going to run into problems again, John Logan, Rick Berman, and Brent Spiner. And it was directed by Stuart Baird. Gino, I know you have the notes this week because for some reason you like this movie. So whenever you're ready, take us into Star Trek Nemesis.
Okay, listeners, what I did this week was pull a lot from Memory Alpha, and I know you don't want to hear me recite it. You can just go check it out yourselves. So I'm just going to recap a couple of the main points that we hit here, because this is a two-hour movie, and I have a lot of clips, and I don't want to make this podcast 8 hours long, because some of you have other things to do in your lives. So in the beginning, we start on Romulus at the Romulan Senate, where some senators are urging to listen to Shinzon's demands. We get a mention of Shinzon right away. Praetor Hirin silences him, saying, "The military does not dictate policy on Romulus. Get out." And Senator Talora also leaves, saying she has a meeting with the Tholian ambassador. She leaves a little device behind, and as they continue talking, the device opens, sprays a green mist into the air, it falls on all of them, and before they can react, everybody decays from the inside and explodes into dust.
And pause. Let's pause for a second, because I'm already starting to run into issues.
Okay.
First of all, security in the Romulan Senate must suck for people that are so paranoid about surveillance and all that sort of stuff, because how does a Romulan senator just get up in the middle of a meeting and leave behind this obvious device? It's not even tiny. It's a big, big circular thing. It looks like a floodlight sort of device or a halo lamp or whatever, and no one notices. They all just sit there. They stare at this thing opening, and they look at, ooh, look at the pretty colors, and then, you know, and then they all die. I mean,
I think this is a really cool opening. I think this movie starts really well. I will give it credit. You start with that shot of the Romulan Senate, and I think Romulus looks like a beautiful planet.
That new shot is awesome.
It does look fantastic. Romulus looks like a really nice place to visit. If it weren't for the Romulans, it's a lot like France. It's a great place to visit. It's a great place to visit, except for the French. But I think the opening scenes of this, I think that's really good. I like the bit in the Romulan Senate. In the Romulan Senate, I'm a big fan of courtroom dramas, and that reminds me of that. And I think that the scene with the radiation and they all start vaporizing, I think that's a fantastic shot. I love that. When you said, Gino, about the effects, you know, the culmination of special effects over the years, I think that's a fantastic scene. I think this movie does start well.
What I can counter your nitpick, Matt, is that these are politicians. I mean, none of these people are the Romulan commanders and warriors that you typically see. These are guys in robes who, you know, go to a courthouse, debate some stuff, and go home. And, you know, Romulan or not, they're politicians.
Yeah, but so, they live in an empire where they learn that everybody's watching them all the time. So you would think that just the threat of surveillance alone, and that the Tal Shiar is out there watching you at this moment, no matter where you are, would at least heighten their senses a bit and make them more perceptive.
It would be safe to assume then that she was cleared to enter the courtroom with that device in the trust that the room was secure.
Well, we'll get into it later, but I have no idea why the Romulans are helping Shinzon anyway.
Okay. Well, as we move on, we get to our first clip at a wedding.
Duty. Starship Captain's life is filled with solemn duty. I have commanded men in battle. I have negotiated peace treaties between implacable enemies. I have represented the Federation in first contact with 27 alien species, but none of this compares with my solemn duty today. As best man. Now, I know on an occasion such as this, it is expected that I be gracious and fulsome in my praise on the wonders of this blessed union. But have the two of you considered what you were doing to me? Of course, you're happy, but what about my needs? This is all a damned inconvenience. I mean, while you are happily settling in on the Titan, I will be training my new first officer. You all know him. He's a tyrannical martinet who will never, ever allow me to go on away missions.
That is the regulation, sir. Starfleet Code, Section 12, Paragraph
4. Mr. Data?
Sir?
Shut up.
Yes, sir.
15 years I've been waiting to say that. No, seriously. Real. Yeah. There's still time to reconsider. Yes?
No.
No? Oh, very well then. Will Riker, you have been my trusted right arm for 15 years. You have kept my course true and steady. Deanna Troi, you've been my guide and my conscience. You have helped me recognize the better parts of myself. You are my family. And in best maritime tradition, I wish you both clear horizons. My good friends, make it so.
The bride and groom.
So there you have it. Picard is the best man at Riker and Troi's wedding. Now, there was some controversy about Troi getting married and, you know, what about Troi and Worf?
Oh, come on.
Well, screw Troi and Worf. That's not one of the problems I have with this movie.
No. Okay.
No. I like this scene. Yeah, I'm happy for them. Yeah, it's a nice scene. Like I say, this movie starts really well. I enjoy this scene. It's nice to see Troi and Riker getting married. There's a nice little bit of humor there. It's a great scene. Will Wheaton shows up. Don't know where Wesley Crusher was a traveller at this point, but he appears in a Starfleet uniform, so that's not explained. I would have liked to have seen that explained, but never mind. It's nice to see him.
That's okay. Worf is an ambassador at this point, and yet he's in a Starfleet uniform.
Both of those things, John Logan explained, and they cut that out of the movie. In fact, the only part that was left even as a deleted scene was them saying, "Oh, hi again, Wesley," where he says he was serving on the Titan and he explains their awesome warp core, but there's a failing there of direction.
I've seen that scene.
They cut a good section out explaining why Worf and Wesley were both there. So it wasn't something they meant to ignore, but it's something that got ignored accidentally.
Well,
I can overlook it considering that Wesley's only in one shot.
Yeah, I suppose, but this goes to one of my main theses for this movie is that Stuart Barrett is an idiot. And, you know, I read that he wanted to cut this whole wedding scene entirely. Like, this was not even supposed to be in the film. And this man does his best to neuter this film of any character moments at all. And that's one of my main problems with Nemesis is that for all the people who bitch and moan about the JJ films having no character moments and all action, this is all action and no character moments. I can point to both Star Trek 2009 and Star Trek Into Darkness where there are genuine moments where the characters get to sit down and have a real conversation. I cannot point to too many moments in this film where that happens. Mm.
And I'm also going to chalk that up to things that were left out. There's a very distinct deleted scene. If you haven't seen it, you can find it on YouTube, or if you do own the special edition DVDs or the Blu-ray of this movie, you'll see the deleted scene.
We're going to talk about the Picard quarter scene, right? Right after this scene?
Yes. After the wedding, Picard and Data in this deleted scene were having a conversation. I can play the deleted scene if you want. I have the clip.
Yeah, let's let people hear it, because people might not know about it.
The Enterprise, his children, are his crew. I don't mean to be sentimental about that, but it's true, and I think he has a somewhat paternal relationship with every member of his crew. And now it's changing, and they're going on to new adventures, whereas Picard is staying where he is. And perhaps a feeling that life is passing him by. Of course, he has to talk like this to Data, because in many respects, Data doesn't understand these feelings. He's a machine and cannot be expected to have that sort of sensitivity to the changes of life. But the conversation that Picard and Data have there is one that will resonate through the movie and become very, very potent in the last 10 or 15 minutes of our film.
I could not help wondering about the human capacity for expressing both pleasure and sadness simultaneously.
Certain human rituals, weddings, birthdays, funerals, evoke very strong and very complex emotions because they mark important transitions in our lives.
They denote the passage of time.
Not just the passage of time, but the presence of time within us. They make us think of our mortality. These occasions encourage us to think about what's behind us and what lies ahead.
And you were particularly aware of this feeling of transition because Commander Riker is leaving to assume command of the Titan.
Will and Deanna joining the Titan? Beverly going to Starfleet Medical.
And this makes you sad?
Well, yes, I suppose it does. A bit. I mean, I'm very happy for them, of course, but I will miss them. The Enterprise will seem not the same without them.
That is because you are used to their presence. Their proximity brings you comfort.
Yes, and frankly, I almost envy them. They've made important decisions. There are great challenges lying ahead of them. New worlds. Seeing Will and Deanna today made me think about some of the decisions I've made. Devoting my life to Starfleet. Not marrying, having children. All the choices that led me here.
The choices I have made have led me here as well, sir. This is the only home I have ever known. I cannot foresee a reason for leaving.
Oh, Data, you never know what's over the horizon. Before long, you'll be offered a command of your own.
If I were, I believe my memory engrams would sense the absence of your proximity, sir. I would miss you.
And are you, Data? Now, you make a toast.
To new worlds, sir.
To new worlds.
So what they basically say here is that Picard and Data have this relationship, and they're very similar in the fact that Picard is seeing his entire family leave, you know, because it's also mentioned in the clip, but something they toss out of the movie, that Beverly announced to to Picard not too long after the wedding that she's going to Starfleet Medical. So Beverly's going, Riker's going, Troy's going. You know, Worf is an ambassador. He's going back to his duties. So the whole family is breaking up. Data mentions that he is in a very similar situation. And as Picard will miss his family, when Data has his own command, he will miss Picard. And that already sets up the relationship between the two. And they're also having a glass of wine. This glass of wine will come into play later in the movie.
Right, and it's a real nice, poignant scene. I mean, I've watched it. It's my favorite scene from the movie, and it's not even in it.
Yeah, that's sad that it's deleted.
But, you know, but this just, it makes me sad watching this scene, to be honest with you, and not for the reasons of the crew breaking up. It makes me sad because I see what this movie was should have been.
Yeah.
It should have been, because I watched the scene, it has a very, very Star Trek VI vibe, which is a movie that I love. And in that movie, the crew is also being retiring. They're going to be decommissioned by the end of it. And they underline those scenes of departure and closure. I mean, she may not be everybody's favorite character, but I really love the scene in that film where, you know, Spock and Valeris are talking about what the future holds for them, and also later, the scene later where Kirk and Spock are talking in their quarters about, are we so old that we outlived our usefulness? Like, things like those needed desperately to be in this film, especially if it was going to be the last one. And by not having him in this in the movie, man, I feel sad. You said that you like this, Gino, because it's the last time you see this TNG crew. By the end of this, I am sad that this is the last time you see the TNG crew, and not because of the reasons that they're hoping for, not because I'm thinking, oh, I'll miss them, they had such a good run. I'm like, they did not get closure. They absolutely did not get closure, and that breaks my heart because TNG was my intro to Star Trek, and if anything, I wanted to see them end well. And I just don't get it. I mean, I got it in All Good Things, mm-hmm. but I don't get it
yeah.
here.
Yeah, and that is one of the sad things about this movie. It is the last time you will see them, and it doesn't give them the proper send-off that they deserve. And I think you're right, Matt. It's quite sad that one of my favorite scenes as well is this, and it wasn't in the movie. You know, it is frustrating, and it is sad because this movie could have been so much more. They just cut the wrong scenes, and that's all down to direction.
Oh yeah, Write a letter to Stuart Baird, because he's the one who was in charge of that.
Yeah.
Yes, this doesn't give as proper closure as would have been necessary for 15 years of many people who were involved in Star Trek's childhoods. A lot of that comes down to timing. They originally thought there was going to be one more movie, and then that rug got pulled out from under them during this movie. So it's hard to make that delineation at this point.
Well, you know what, though? I don't buy that so much, only because I can't imagine that these people were stupid. Now, maybe they were, maybe they were ignorant, but let's look at the state of Star Trek in 2002, because I think it's undeniable, even to us as fans, that it was on the decline with the general public. I mean, Insurrection posted modest numbers, but it was really kind of disliked by both the fans and the general audiences, and it was just barely a success. I mean, it made its money back, it made a profit, but huge step down from the profits they saw from First Contact. Deep Space Nine goes off the air, and that's, generally, that's the last series that everybody kind of agrees on that they liked. So, for the last couple of years of TV seasons, you had Voyager, which people don't really care for and was declining in ratings in season 6 and 7.
Yeah.
Then you had Enterprise, which started strong but quickly lost viewers just within its first season alone. And yeah. by now it's in season 2, which people generally really dislike.
Yeah, yeah. This is, at this point, pretty much the death of Star Trek, isn't it? Where we really are struggling here at this point.
So, you know, these people, you would think that at least the bean counters at Paramount and the producers here would be aware that this might be the last go-around and go into this movie with that intention, because it very well could be, and it was. Spoiler alert.
I see so. What you're talking about with their intention, and they over-intended it. And what I mean by that is something that Larry made a point about. Do you want to hear what he had to say?
Yeah, let's hear what he had to
definitely.
Say.
what in your eyes made it a great movie?
I'll say this. I think Nemesis gets dumped on way too much. I think part of the reason is it's like people's perceptions more maybe than what their initial take was. I just remember that at the time, Nemesis, even apart from whatever happened with the actual people that made the movie, Paramount's marketing, features, whatever, had it shoehorned in there with a Harry Potter and a James Bond, and it was crammed into that holiday time in December when I guess the ego of things thought that that's when it had to be. If it wasn't going to be a summer movie, which it should have been, they were going to shoehorn it in there. And I just remember as the theatrical distribution world was changing, I remember a lot of fans were stunned that there were I'm not indie, I'm going to go on opening night and support it. You know, they were in the, I'm going to go when it's not the mob. There are a lot of people that are like way about going to see movies. Mm-hmm. Even way back in ancient times, like 2002. And there were an awful lot of people. I remember saying, I waited for the second weekend to go see it, and my local theater had already squeezed it out. Like, I couldn't find it. They were like, what? It's a Star Trek movie. What do you mean it's not around the second weekend? There were a lot of people who intended to pay ticket money and see it in the theater, and it wasn't out on the second weekend. Because not because it tanked so much, but partly because it didn't, like, number one with a bullet, but also because there were so many other movies that perceived to be bigger blockbusters that were going to premiere. It was a crowded field. And the smaller markets that just had one and two and three screens, you know, gave them over for those other movies. So there were a lot of people who were stunned that they couldn't go see Nemesis.
There's that, which Larry just had to say, and the fact that this is 2002, and the problem I've said with Enterprise before was just the state of America at that time. I mean, you have the attacks in 2001. After that, every TV show on the air went to, there's a terrorist attack, let's go get the terrorists, because that was the American mindset in general. So Enterprise is going into that, and that's why it's starting to suck, because you got the Zindi attacks right around then, right?
Yeah, you get the Zindi attacks right around in 2003, so at the end of the second season. So just after this.
Yeah, so people are afraid to go outside. I mean, they made a real, like, Cold War style, we're going to get attacked by nuclear weapons at any second, go hide in your bunker for years. That's how people lived in America. So I'm not going to go out and see a movie. And plus, the people who were going out to see movies were seeing Harry Potter and James Bond.
Well, I'm going to disagree with Larry slightly there. I'm not saying he's wrong. I just see it as having observed movie-going audiences for the past summer because, personal intro, like, ever since I started working, I've had more income, and I've gone to a lot of movies this summer more so than, or this last year more so than any other year before. So I kind of see what the trends are now. Now, I don't know what they were like in 2002, but Harry Potter and James Bond, both franchises that were releasing around that time, had released their films in mid to late November. So by the time you get to December 13th, 2002, most of the people who wanted to see those films have come out and seen. And the same thing happened this summer with when they released Star Trek Into Darkness 2 weeks after Iron Man 3. People who wanted to go see Iron Man had already gone to see Iron Man, and Star Trek Into Darkness, even though it didn't post the numbers that Paramount wanted for opening weekend, it still made number one. And the thing with Nemesis is that not only did it not make number one, but it didn't lose to Harry Potter. It didn't lose to James Bond. It didn't even lose to Two Towers because Two Towers came out after Nemesis. It lost to Made in Manhattan, that J-Lo movie.
Oh, man.
So, you know what? As much as I respect what Larry's perspective and stuff like that, and I don't doubt that played a factor, I don't think it was the main factor because if Harry Potter or James Bond had posted number one that week and not Nemesis, then you could say that was a factor.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, it was Made in Manhattan that dethroned Star Trek and gave Star Trek its only week, the only Star Trek movie to not open at number one was because of that movie. So I don't know if you knew that, Gino, but
I didn't know that.
That's what happened.
Okay. I'm still going to stand on my soapbox, though, and say it was timing because Enterprise was getting some hate, so who wants to see Star Trek right now? Star Trek sucks right now. Yeah. And
Star Trek wasn't cool at that point, was it?
See, and I agree with that part, which is why I say I think the smart move would have been to go in with the intention that this was the last movie from the get-go.
Sure, and to release it in the summer.
No, I disagree there, too, because...
How? If they wanted to push this in for, like, Oscar nominations and stuff like that, of course release it in Christmas, but...
No. Both blockbuster seasons at that point would have been toxic for Star Trek. Because the franchise is on the decline, because people don't want to see it anyway, summer's even more crowded than the holidays. So if you're going to say that that's going to play a factor into why Nemesis didn't do well during the holiday season, it's going to get killed when it's put up against superhero franchises and big summer action movies. And if Star Trek's not popular, releasing it in the summer season's not going to make it popular.
Okay.
So the only reason they've been able to do that recently is because Star Trek has, again, broadened its appeal to the mainstream, and that's why a thing like Star Trek 2009, that's why Star Trek Into Darkness can be released during the summers, because now that the audience is back and they can get the numbers, now we can release it during the summer. But at that point, not going to happen. Not with the modest returns of Insurrection, not with the declining ratings of Voyager and Enterprise. There's no way you could release that during the summer.
I feel you there.
If you release it in, like, the best way they could have done this, the best case scenario would have been to release it during a month where nothing's playing, like a March or a September or something.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that being said, does that make this movie less good than it was?
Well, that's not the reason that this movie is less good than it was. That's a factor, is what I'm saying. Okay. That's not my main problem with this film. We've got 2 hours worth of plot to go through.
Right. You know, and that was the point that Larry was making. It's not about the movie. It was about timing and the crowds, and so I get your point that you're saying there. Let's move on with the movie, because we've been talking for half an hour, and we just got past the opening. We get a signal as we're on the way to Beta Z that there's a positronic signal out there in the Kalaran system. They go down to the planet and try out the Argo, which, Riker says, you can't go on away missions. Picard says, I'm itching to try the Argo. They go. Matt is telling me to take a timeout right now because I know you hate the Argo. And yes, a land-based vehicle was a bad idea, but let's talk timing a little bit. Voyager's home. Tom Paris made the Delta Flyer, and it was awesome. It survived the rest of the trip, didn't it?
Yes.
In that case, they very well could have been trying out new shuttle forms, and with somebody like Tom Paris making new equipment for Starfleet, of course they're going to make something like a dude.
Okay, but what works for Tom Paris should not work for Jean-Luc Picard. And I have several... This is where the problems start in earnest. First of all, this starts the whole convoluted B4 storyline that we're going to get into, which makes no damn sense.
None whatsoever.
It makes no sense, and when you say that this is a well-constructed movie, I hold up B4. Because none of this plotline, as we go through it, makes any sense to me whatsoever.
B4 opens the doors for subterfuge to get all the information about Star
Trek. But it's how that goes about. That's the problem. And I'll explain as we go through the plot.
Okay.
But here's where another problem that I have with this movie, characters acting so out of character. And I don't know if this was John Logan, and I don't know if this was the producer stepping in saying we got to have action, but here's my main problem with the Argo and this whole scene. Jean-Luc Picard, how you would describe him as a captain throughout the course of the series, and even the previous three movies, even the last movie that came out 4 years ago, he is a man who will kill himself, kill his crew, kill anybody in order to not break the Prime Directive. He will die. He will sacrifice his own life before he ever allows himself to break the Prime Directive. He'll most let Wesley die, not to break the Prime Directive. So you have this man who supposedly worships the Prime Directive. You get told that they find this positronic body on this planet with a pre-warp society. And the Picard that I know, and the Picard that would be consistent with his character, would make every effort possible to make this like a covert recovery so as to not disturb the planet's population, to not risk contact with any of them, and to get out as quickly as possible. The Picard in this movie takes this stupid land-based vehicle that's designed to do nothing but attract attention and, you know, put his crew at risk. That thing does not offer protection at all. I mean, there's no shields. There's no even protection from the elements. This thing is substandard to a Humvee, Gino. A Humvee offers more protection than the Argo. And
it's a little more covert. I mean,
it's not
more covert. They land in a small shuttle. They take a quick vehicle.
A small shuttle? Did you see how big that thing was?
To carry a vehicle that could travel, you know, faster than they could walk, it has to be a little bit bigger.
No. This is Picard not giving a damn about the Prime Directive and him enjoying redneck off-road driving, which is not Jean-Luc Picard. I'm sorry. You can't. There's no excuse for this. There's absolutely no excuse for this, especially if you're claiming to be a fan of Star Trek. You can't tell me you're a fan of Star Trek and then write the characters out of character.
I don't see how it's out of character. I mean, Picard enjoyed riding horses in Generations. I mean, he enjoys...
So riding horses translates to off-road redneck driving?
I wouldn't call it redneck driving. He enjoys going fast. I mean, who doesn't?
This is NASCAR crap. I mean, you just expect, like, to them to turn on the radio and Cotton Eye Joe to be playing. You know, it's just... But this is a clear and utter violation of the Prime Directive, something which Picard fought against in the last movie. The whole reason he does the insurrection is because he feels it's a violation of the Prime Directive to move the Baku. And right away, it's telling me we don't care about previous established characterization. We're going to do whatever feels right for the movie.
Now, the Argo itself, I don't have a problem with, but I would agree with you, Matt, in that this is very out of character for Jean-Luc Picard. He would not have gone down to that planet and just violated the Prime Directive in that way. No way. I have much more of a problem with the B4 plot, which I'm sure we're going to get onto very, very shortly.
We are. And one more thing about this scene, you know, and it's another nitpicky thing, but it's a directing choice which I don't like. I don't like the way this sequence is filmed. It's filmed with that same sort of in-style filter, or I don't know what it is, but it's a washed-out frame color, and it was... It's very reminiscent of some of the movies at the time, such as, like, I think Black Hawk Down came out around the same period, and it's just... For me, it doesn't work aesthetically with Star Trek. I don't like the way that this planet sequence is filmed, but...
That's fine. You have to chalk that up to a directing choice, though. I mean, if that was the popular way to film things at the time, a guy going with what was popular is, I'm sure, in his mind, a safe bet.
Right, which I say, I know it's a nitpick, but I just don't care for the way this sequence is filmed.
And you're perfectly entitled to your nitpicks, Matt, and please keep going. Yes, I'm it's sure out of character for Picard, but Picard just went to a wedding, and... The only other Soong-type android they've ever seen before was Lore. So,
and Lal.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Lal. But that
and
was...
Juliana.
Okay. You're breaking my point apart here, Matt. Mark.
That's my part. That's our goal.
Okay, well, they find an android who looks exactly like Data. They get him aboard the ship, and he's arguably, as LaForge says, more primitive than Data. He perhaps could have been a prototype. They ask his name. He says it's B4. Picard makes a comment about Dr. Soong's penchant for whimsical names. Larry told me the original name for the android was B9, but all the Lost in Space fans would have commented that was a B9 type robot, so they changed it.
I don't know. I mean, B4's existence doesn't bother me because in that, you know, if we're looking for strict continuity Trek fans, if in that episode that Merk mentioned with Data's mom, the mom android says, there were like four other prototypes before you before we got Lore. And so I chalked it up as B4 was one of those prototypes.
Yeah, it's not impossible to say there were other Soong-type Data-looking androids out there.
That's not my biggest problem with this. My biggest problem is what they're going to use B4 for. And my other problem with the whole B4 storyline is, obviously, when you look at who wrote this movie, this is you know this is what Spiner contributed to this film. This is why his name is on the credits, in the written by credits. And it just feels so self-indulgent. And I'm going to call Spiner out on it the same way I called Shatner out in 5. I mean, if this is indeed going to be your last film, everybody needs a moment. Everybody in Star Trek VI got a moment.
Brent Spiner's contribution to Star Trek Nemesis was that he wanted Data to die. B4 was not his invention. His thinking was that I am finished playing Data because I've been doing this character for 15 years, and regardless of an aging chip, I've taken the character as far as it's going to go.
Yeah. So he wanted out at this point, didn't he?
He wanted out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I understand that. I understand that. But I don't know if even if he didn't make up the idea, I'm sure he contributed to some of these scenes. And okay. They just feel self-indulgent. And like I said, I'm not going to be biased against the original series. I called Shatner out on the same thing. I'm going to call Spiner out on the same thing. I love Brent Spiner. I like him more than William Shatner. But I'm still going to call him out on it. And okay. And again, as we go through this movie, one of my biggest problems is knowing that this is the ending, and they should have known right away. Everybody needs a chance in the spotlight, even if it's something dumb and whimsical like Uhura trying to speak Klingon. I mean, that at least reminded me of, you know, the good times that I had with this character, as dumb as it was. So we're going to talk about what they do to some of the characters in these films, and it's this film, and it's ugly. Not only is it not satisfying, it is ugly.
But not at the fault of John Logan, and we'll talk about that. But let's move on with the movie, shall we? Because up next, we get something that us as Voyager fans have been looking forward to since the series itself went off the air. A call from Admiral Janeway.
Admiral Janeway, how good to see you again.
Jean-Luc, how'd you like a trip to Romulus?
With or without the rest of the fleet?
A diplomatic mission. We've been invited, believe it or not. Seems there's been some kind of internal political shakeup. The new praetor, someone called Shinzon, has requested a Federation envoy.
New praetor?
There's more. He's Riemann. Believe me, we don't understand it either. You're the closest ship, so I want you to go and hear what he has to say. Get the lay of the land. If the Empire becomes unstable, it could mean trouble for the entire quadrant.
Understood.
We're sending you all the intelligence we have, but it's not much. I don't need to tell you to watch your back, Jean-Luc.
Hardly.
The Sona, the Borg, the Romulans. You seem to get all the easy assignments.
Just lucky, Admiral.
Let's hope that luck holds. Janeway out.
That was a fun little scene with Janeway.
I wanted to.
It's nice to see Janeway. It is
when
nice.
When I clipped this, well, when I told Gino which scenes I wanted to clip, I included this because we're the Delta Quadrant. I figured we'd at least get the scene with Janeway in here. So
she had a few more lines that they did originally cut out. She was also supposed to mention Dr. Soren.
Yeah, which is kind of like, it's too much on the nose, because I read the full line was supposed to be the Borg, the Sona, even that pesky Dr. Soren.
Yes, like, why? Dr. Soren.
And I'm like, he's faced much more, but we're just going to name the things that happened in the last 4 movies.
Sure. Okay. But it's a nice little teasing moment, because Janeway's been to hell and back. You know, she's been to the other end of the galaxy, and
I'm sorry, Gino, but this kind of spoils you for the end of Voyager, because obviously
I knew they made it home. Yeah, I mean,
but you don't know the circumstances, and this right. And this means Janeway, as you know her, is alive.
Yes. Well, after that happens, Picard walks out, says, "Change of plans. We're going to Romulus. Warp 8. Let's go." And we start talking about the Riemanns, who we haven't really explored before.
Heard of.
No. Yeah.
Heard of. Because in the original series, when they were talking about Romulus and Remus, I always thought before this movie that Romulus and Remus are the two homeworlds of the Romulan Empire. And I just thought Remus was another planet filled with Romulans, because that's what they characterized it as in TOS.
Well, bad guy or not, wouldn't you avoid the fact that, oh yeah, we've got a planet of people who we're holding as slaves over here?
I mean, I don't know, but you would think that this would have come up. I get why it didn't, because of the whole behind-the-scenes stuff, and this was something new for this movie, but But the only thing I'll say about it is in the future is that in the future, Enterprise, when they do Romulan episodes, do have Riemann bodyguards show up. And that's, even though I don't like the Riemanns and I don't like the continuity, at least of this movie, at least that's nice continuity between this movie and Enterprise. That's the most I'll give it.
Right, but it shouldn't have been. I would actually argue that, because Enterprise is beforehand, and if we've never met Riemanns before this, then bad.
No, but the humans in Enterprise don't meet the Riemanns. You just see Riemanns walking along with Romulans in Enterprise.
Okay. All right, well, as we move along, we learn that Remus is tidally locked. They're primarily dilithium mines on the planet. All the Riemanns live on the dark side because the light side is super hot because it's always facing the sun.
They get better reception, so they can listen to more Pink Floyd there.
Right. The dark side of Remus. Picard asks about Shinzon, and Data says all Starfleet has is pretty much his military record. He's pretty young but capable, and he's fought 12 successful engagements in the war. At this
Which
point,
the
war.
The Dominion War.
Oh, the war. Oh, the Dominion War. Okay.
The Dominion War that's going on at the time, which they do mention that Riemann soldiers were actually used as cannon fodder.
They do, yeah.
This is, so, I just want to point out in Star Trek continuity, this is after the Dominion War.
Yeah, that's why I was asking which war, yeah.
this takes place 5 years after the end of Deep Space Nine. Just to put it in perspective.
Okay. So, from there, we see Data downloading information to B4.
Okay, well, let's pause for a second, because I forgot to mention something about B4 in the first scene. So, as you mentioned, Gino, who was the last Sun Taika android that they ran across that looked like Data?
Lore.
And what happened with Lore?
Lore was kind of a douche.
And so the natural impulse when they run into another one of these things is to put him together without question.
That's Starfleet.
Number one. Okay, well, but still a plot hole. And still doesn't acknowledge continuity from this so-called fan.
I would understand leave his arms and legs off, maybe, but I don't know. I think you give Data all the benefits of the doubt.
No. But here it's even compounded worse. Because now we're going to do this memory transfer, which not only telegraphs the ending like nobody's business, but it also, like, now you're giving him access to all of Data's knowledge, and Data's knowledge includes that of Starship operations and the Enterprise and tactical information and stuff like that to this android that you know nothing about. What a stupid breach of security. And I get, you know, it's they try to play it off with Data, like, oh, I just want him to be all that he could possibly be and all that garbage. But it's retarded. I'm sorry, I know that's not a PC word, but...
No, it is. Passing all of that top-secret information out of Data's head into B4 is stupid. But the biggest problem I have with this whole thing is for years they'd gone through saying Data was sentient. Data was sentient. He has his own mind, and then they decide that they can just transfer his brain into someone else's body. And that takes the sentience away from Data. That treats Data like a USB stick, that they can just transfer his mind into another body, and he's okay. You cannot do that with people. And that's one of the biggest problems I have with this whole B4 plot.
Well, you know, that's interesting, Mark. I didn't think about that in this scene. I thought about it in the scene that's coming up later. And I'll explain which scene where the sentience became sort of a problem for me. But it's so tactically unsound. And this is the crew of the flagship. They've been through a lot at this point, and this is their last adventure. They should know better. I mean, this is to be honest with you, and as much as I love this series, this is a Voyager thing to do. I mean, it's just...
Well, what I'm seeing here, the point you're making here, and the point you made at the very start of the movie, is the assumption that the characters should have known better. A lot of times, people are just caught with their pants down. And I think this situation, they're all happy, and Picard's kind of feeling sorry for himself that everybody's leaving, and he's trying to hold on to anything he can. That's why even Geordi kind of gives him a look when he says, you know, reassemble him. Geordi is skeptical, and Picard's not really thinking.
Okay, but I need more than a... First of all, I need more than a look.
Okay.
Second of all, I mean, getting caught with your pants down once or twice or is fine, but at this point, the TNG crew, through their various adventures, has been caught in multiple stages with their pants down, and this is a situation that is playing out exactly like a situation that they've had before. Like, beat for beat, this happened with Lore. So, you know, getting caught with their pants, it's an old saying, like, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. You know, by this time, it's fool me 700 times.
I jump out an airlock. Same situation, but you can't always assume that every pre-Data android is going to be Lore.
No, but then again,
that he, you know, probably doesn't have the motor skills to be able to take them over, much less cognitive.
But even if you don't, you still learn from the last time.
Yeah,
you be more
don't
cautious.
You take more extra security.
Yeah. Like you don't do just the same boneheaded thing again. I need to see people learning from their mistakes.
I mean, I'm going to give them the mistake that they decided to download all of Data's information. To me, that doesn't make this a bad movie. That makes that a dumb choice by Starfleet.
I'm not saying this alone makes it a bad movie. I'm saying that this movie is just... I find plot hole here and plot hole here. And I know that Star Trek has plot holes. I'm well aware that Star Trek has plot holes. In movies that I defend, I know that there's plot holes. But these are, you know, usually I can get over these things. But they just keep coming. And in some of these later movies... you know, that I'm talking about that I defend, there are plot holes, but they kind of do their best to deflect. They don't draw attention to themselves. They find other clever ways around it. And here, instead of finding other clever ways around it, I'm just going, plot hole, another plot hole, three more plot holes, and then they're not doing anything to take my mind off of it.
A high-speed, all-terrain vehicle, you might not feel these holes as much as you would.
That sounded dirty. But I'm just trying to get across to the audience here that even though I said I was turning on the snark, I'm really trying to illustrate why this movie, for me, there's more problems than other movies, which I know also have problems, but I can get over. And I'm trying to make that distinction clear. And
you're making clear points here, still doesn't make me love this movie any less.
No, I'm not trying to win you over. I'm just trying to illustrate why this is not working for me and will continue to just slide downhill, especially when we talk about Shinzon and his motivation, which, again, don't make sense. This is something that I just mentioned, but this scene also, poor storytelling, telegraphs the ending. Like I know from this, even when I was 14 watching this movie, not knowing much about it, I knew Data was going to die just from this scene. And, it would be akin, I heard this on another podcast, and I'm trying not to take other points from other people's podcasts, but someone said the way that they bring in B4 and do what they do with him in this film would have been like in Star Trek 2, hey, this is Spock's twin brother that's coming along for this mission, and we've never heard of him before, but he looks exactly like Spock, and he'll be joining us for this trainee mission. I mean, it's the same kind of poor telegraphing that ultimately contributes to the fact that this hurts the storyline for me.
I can see that, yes, but in order for story-wise, if they were going to decide to continue the Data character, even if it were in the body of B4, then you can't introduce him in the last 10 minutes of the movie. I mean, they didn't make a new Spock, they regrew Spock.
Well, if you want my honest thing with this, Gino, if they had somehow made a different movie out of this and just killed Data off in a better way than they do here, I would have been fine with him not being able to come back because his death.
Honestly, it would have been a good goodbye. I will agree with you there, and I think that's what Brent Spiner wanted, and he didn't get.
Yeah.
But you know what? You keep saying that he wants out, he wants out, he wants out. If they made another TNG movie, he would have to come back.
Yes, because they've got a get out clause, haven't they? And I don't think that's what Brent Spiner wanted. So. The whole B4 thing just bothers me.
I can get that, Matt. And that makes sense that if they made another TNG movie, he would have to come back. But if you spent the last 15 years doing a certain job that over those years, you became a millionaire because you did that job, and they said, we're going to have you do this job one more time. One, you've got a great agent that knows how much you make who will say, here is a several million dollar paycheck. Of course you're going to take it, whether or not you hate it. And this is a problem we ran into dealing with Stuart Baird during this movie. These people have been doing this job for so long. They've been making so much money doing it. They know what the characters would do. And Stuart Baird said, no. In fact, Marina Sirtis mentioned this. Would you like to hear a clip from her?
Yes, let's hear from Marina.
It was challenging. I mean, Stuart's a really nice bloke, but to have someone come in who's never, ever seen Star Trek before, and when you say to him, you know, well, my character wouldn't do that, and he says, I don't care, do it anyway. You know, first of all, you want to punch his lights out, but second of all, he is the director, and you kind of have to do what he says, because he just keeps making you do it over and over again until you do. So there was a kind of, I don't know, it was almost like you had to kind of go with it and say, okay, I'm just going to see what happens, try and find a way to make this work. And, you know, I hate to say this because I'm a woman, you know, as you can see, but he was right. It turned out to be a great movie, so, and people who know me specifically will know how hard it is for me to say that someone else is right, but he was.
I want to know when that interview was, because...
Yeah. And how much she was paid to say that.
Because Marina Sirtis, in later conventions, especially recently, have said that when they're on press junkets for movies, actors tell the press that this is the greatest thing that they've ever made.
Yeah, of course they do. Yeah,
and she has come out in recent years, along with LeVar Burton, along with Michael Dorn, along with Jonathan Frakes, and have trashed this movie.
Yeah, okay, but I'm sure you can understand talking to the press. It's like the same thing if you talk bad about Creation Entertainment. Good luck ever having a panel there.
Right. No, I agree that's what's going on, but I'm just saying, don't take what Marina's saying there as what her true feelings are, because I know what her true feelings are.
The main point I wanted to make with her having that speech there was the very start of it, talking about how Stuart Baird didn't know anything about Star Trek, and they were just trying to say, okay, let's see what happens. Apparently on set, it was almost a daily thing that someone was having a gigantic argument with him, saying, yeah, what the crap are you doing?
This is not something my character
just do it. Just do it anyway. And that's the problem with this movie. He just says, just do it anyway. I don't care what your character would do. I know my character. I know what they would do. Just do it anyway. They were just forced into it, and that's one of the problems with the movie.
Stuart Baird is British, so for the listeners, that was a kind of a reenactment right there. Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. But, my pleasure.
I'm not gonna totally destroy Stuart Baird's whole career, because I've seen he's a brilliant editor. I mean, he's edited some of the best films that have ever been made, in my opinion. But I just don't like it when people diss on J.J. Abrams, and again, I'm bringing this up, but I get that the man didn't like Star Trek, but I think what he did differently is he listened to his writers who did like Star Trek, and he wanted to honor the legacy of Star Trek. He felt that he had that responsibility, even though he didn't like it himself, he still felt like he had that legacy to live up to, and he listened to his writers, he listened to his actors. It was much more of a collaborative experience, and the same thing happened with Nicholas Meyer and Harve Bennett, neither of which had watched Star Trek, neither of which were fans of Star Trek. Harve Bennett made the effort when he was writing and producing Star Trek II to sit down and watch every episode of the original series, all 79 of them, to get the feel of how these characters talked, how they were, their characterizations, what they would do, what they wouldn't do, etc., etc. And he made damn sure when he was working on that script that these characters were acting in character. And I'm sorry, but when you're dealing with a juggernaut as big as Star Trek, there needs to be that, at least, even if you don't like it, you need to respect it, and you need to know where these people are coming from. Like, listen to
me. I agree with you 100%, Matt. Stuart Baird had no respect.
He had no respect for
the franchise, and it showed in the way the movie turned out. However, I still love this movie.
That's the thing we keep coming back to, and I'm like, I'm waiting to hear why.
You will.
We're all looking forward to that moment.
Let's move on, because at this point, we finally, like 10 minutes into the movie, meet Shinzon. We see his ship, who, after sitting there for 17 hours, finally decides to turn off his cloak. And, I mean, the thing's got 52 disruptor banks, 27 photon torpedo bays, primary, secondary shields. I mean, it's a beast. And they show a clip of this up against the Enterprise E, which was gigantic, making the Enterprise E look tiny.
Question. Where do these supposed slaves get the resources and the ability to build this ship?
They've got Romulans in their pocket.
Yeah, not the whole amount of Romulus who pretty much despises Remans?
Well, they've got a lot of dilithium, haven't they? I guess they're holding someone to ransom there.
And where do you build something like this?
It's a cool ship.
It's a cool ship, but where do you build something like this where people don't notice?
Star Trek MacGuffin.
It's a Star Trek MacGuffin, and full credit to, I'm not trying to be biased here, same thing happens in Star Trek Into Darkness with the Vengeance, but I give the Vengeance a pass because I figure it's Section 31, they're working with the CNC, and if they want to keep something covered up, they can keep something covered up. I guess I'll let it go for Nemesis, but it's more of a problem for me in Nemesis.
I guess it could be a rogue Tal Shiar agent.
Yeah, that's the only explanation I could come up with.
And possibly.
It's harder, I'm just saying it's a little harder for me to swallow in this film.
Okay. Well, as the ship finally appears, they get hailed, they see this ugly-looking dude, Picard's like, oh hey, Praetor Shinzon! And this guy says, I'm not Shinzon, I am his Praetor. Do you know who this actor was?
His viceroy. And yes, I want to give full credit to Ron Perlman.
Ron freaking Perlman!
The man of a thousand faces and makeup jobs. I mean, there's nothing... He's not the problem I have with this film. Okay, like, he does his best. Now, what he's given is not much, but I do like him.
It's a bit part. I love seeing big actors in bit parts.
He's just a fun presence. Cool. He's a fun presence in any movie, whether it's Hellboy or whether it's even Alien Resurrection. I love him in Alien Resurrection. He's just fun to be around. Now, this character is not fun to be around.
Oh, no,
but,
no.
But we're going to get into that and some of the ugliness of this movie that I just... despise.
Right. Well, this character tells them we're sending over transport coordinates. So an away team goes over. Granted, kind of a large away team, but it's a huge diplomatic mission, so they don't have to worry about danger. So you're talking about Picard, Riker, Worf, Data, and Troy.
The whole senior staff minus Beverly, basically. Like, what the hell is this?
Well, they beam down, and we meet Shinzon.
I hope you'll forgive the darkness. We are not comfortable in the light.
Praetor Shinzon?
Captain Picard. Jean-Luc Picard. I'd always imagined you a little taller. Isn't that odd? You may scan me without subterfuge, Commander Data.
You are not as we imagined you.
No?
You are human. Why have you asked us to come here? Praetor?
I've never met a human woman before.
I'm only half human.
Deanna Troi, of Beta Zed. Empathic and telepathic abilities. Ship's counselor. All this I knew, but I never knew you were so beautiful.
You seem quite familiar with our personnel.
Oh, I am, Commander Riker. May I touch your hair?
We came to Romulus on a matter we were assured was of great importance. If you have anything to say to us as representatives of the Federation, I suggest you do it now.
Yes. I'm sorry, Captain. There is so much we need to talk about.
I would be interested to know what we are talking about.
Unity, Captain. Tearing down the walls between us to recognize that we are one. I'm talking of the thing that makes us the same. Peace. We want peace. Right now, you're thinking this all sounds too good to be true. But you're also thinking that the chance for peace is too promising to ignore. Am I right?
Yes.
Then perhaps it's time to add some illumination to our discussion. Computer, raise the lighting 4 levels.
They turn on the lights and Shinzon's a human. And Picard notices right away, holy crap, this guy looks exactly like I did, you know, several years ago.
And he's the only one who notices that. Because I do not buy for a second that this is the same person.
No. I thought you'd be taller. You're a clone. You're a clone of... Obviously, we don't know that yet, but
they
he's
have
a clone.
Dinner later. After
he's
this
a clone,
scene...
He's a clone of Picard.
After this scene, Shinzon does invite Picard to have dinner with him. And they're talking later, and Picard says, so, you thought I'd be taller? And Shinzon kind of laughs it off and says, huh, yeah, I always thought I would hit 2 meters.
But Picard
says, me too.
It doesn't really matter, because this is the whole crux of this movie. This movie is called Star Trek Nemesis. Nemesis meaning your equal, you know, equal opposite or your equal rival.
Your evil version of yourself, yes.
I mean, and I do not buy for a single second that this person is the same. He doesn't look like Picard. He doesn't. It's the baldness notwithstanding. I mean, they
and the whole baldness thing is stupid as well.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that later. But they raise the way this film, this scene is shot, right? The lights come up. It's this big revelation, and Picard has this look on his face, and we're supposed to get it from that shot that they're the same person. I do not, and that scene just falls flat.
I don't think we're supposed to get it from that
shot.
Oh,
yes, you are.
Later on that he's a clone.
No. That's for the slower members of the audience. But from that shot, the way it's framed, Gino, it's like this big, it's like a halo of light surrounds this guy, and he comes up out of the darkness, and you see the close-up of his face, and you see the close-up of Patrick Stewart's face. And that is supposed to convey to me, the audience member, that they're if not the same person, there's supposed to be a resemblance of something between them. And for me, there is none. I mean,
what they're trying to tell you is that Picard is familiar with him. That's it. You don't have to infer that, because they're going to show you later. This is made for the same audience of people that they were afraid to tie in a lot of other Star Trek-y type of things, because they were worried that Star Trek-y people wouldn't get it. This is the same crew of people saying, our audience is a bunch of idiots. So here we're going to lay everything out for you. So all they're showing you is what you're getting shown. Picard has a look on his face for some reason.
You know what? I hate being assumed that I'm an idiot. And maybe that plays into part of it, but I know what they were trying to say with this scene, even when I saw it at 14. And the fact of the matter is, I like Tom Hardy. This is Tom Hardy, by the way, who's now famous for being in Christopher Nolan movies, and I think he's brilliant. I don't know if he's brilliant here, because the character is written and his motivation is so incredibly poor, but we'll get to that.
Did you hear a little bit of the Bane voice when he was doing that speech, though?
Not really, but like I could imagine what it would sound like with the Bane voice.
When it dropped down a little bit, I heard a little bit of Bane.
But
I haven't seen him in anything else, but I do understand he's quite good.
He is good.
Have you not seen Dark Knight Rises?
No, I haven't seen any of the recent Batman trilogy movies.
And I'm not a Batman fan. Have you not seen Inception either?
I have seen Inception. Is he?
He's in Inception.
Okay.
That's where he kind of came back into the limelight for me. I was watching Inception, and I look at this guy, and he's... First of all, he buffed up in 8 years, because here he's real skinny. He's like...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I hate to make it innuendo, but he looks like AIDS skinny. And
he is actually, at that time, even, he was still pretty well built. The suit made him look scrawny. That was the point. They wanted him to look almost kind of sickly right
And
here.
Boy, do those suits look stupid. But that's a
that's
whole
Star Trek costumes. At least they didn't dress up, put a horn on a dog.
But come on, can we make it any more obvious that we're evil? Right to the pointy sorcerer shoulders. I mean, come on.
Pointy sorcerer shoulders.
But regardless, and we'll come back to that chestnut in a minute. But
they actually did reuse the uniforms later, I believe, for Zindi.
For the Zindi,
yeah.
And they look equally as stupid. But. Tom Hardy is a good actor, and I've seen him in other stuff. He's brilliant now with Christopher Nolan. I watched him. I was watching Inception, and I was in the theater, and I'm like, I know that voice, and I think I know that face, but this is like some real buff dude. And then I look at the credits, and it's Tom Hardy, and I'm like, that was Shinzon? And it was total transformation. Like, and I've been a fan of his since. But in this movie, they're wanting to portray someone who's Captain Picard's younger self or equal. And just from conversing with Mark and other people from TrekMate, they don't even have the same accent. Like, you know, I think they come from different parts of England. And I don't even know why Shinzon would have an accent, because accents are not genetic.
I was just gonna say to your first point, how would he have the same accent? He was raised, you know, on Remus.
How would he have an accent, period, Gino?
Yeah.
Would he even be speaking English? He's probably speaking Reman, and they're hearing him through the
translator. Yes, exactly. So, Patrick Stewart's from Yorkshire, and his accent, as you hear it now, is not Yorkshire. You guys probably wouldn't know the difference, but Patrick Stewart speaks with a very southern accent, as I do, but he's from Yorkshire. So this guy would speak with a Reman accent. It makes no sense at all. I don't get any of that. Unless the universal translator is picking it up, and maybe it makes everyone sound like a generic home county southern English person, possibly.
Well, just to that point, Mark, most Americans believe that British people sound very proper just because of the accent.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. Yeah.
Okay, well,
you have bowler hats and umbrellas.
Yeah, but, Don't you get handed that at birth?
The last thing I want to underline about the scene before we move on, and I'm sorry, Gina, I'm just underlining all my points here, is that for the next 20 minutes, roughly, we're going to be hemming and hawing of whether this guy wants peace. And I'm sorry, but you could tell from this scene that that's not even true. Captain Picard, all we want is peace. Like, who the hell is going to believe him? And the fact that we're going to spend the next 25 minutes twiddling our damn thumbs wondering what the real plot is. And I don't even know what the real plot is at the end of the day, because when you find out his quote-unquote motivation, which changes several times within scenes, by the way, none of it makes sense. And I'll point those out as we go along.
To your first point, Tom Hardy does not look like Patrick Stewart. He doesn't sound like him. Aside from the fact that he's bald in the movie, no. But I'm going to chalk that up to casting. I mean, unless you find an actor who has a similar build from Yorkshire.
How about this? I would have loved it if Patrick Stewart played Shinzon. That would have been killer, and I would have, like...
He had to be a young, sexy guy. That was John Logan's... it was on John Logan's wish list. He had to be a young guy.
Well, then,
Patrick Stewart could not play a young guy at this point.
He couldn't play a young guy
at season one TNG.
He couldn't play a young guy, but he's damn sexy even at 70-something. So, you know.
Okay, well...
What I would have loved about from this scene is if Shinzon was like speaking through a modulator, and so you couldn't tell what his real voice was, then all of a sudden it shuts off and he's still in the darkness and it's Patrick Stewart's voice.
That would have been awesome.
That's brilliant. I would have loved that. But to your second point about them wondering whether or not he's good or evil or anything, and overlooking the fact that he's flying a gigantic warship, let's look at it from...
That minor detail.
If I had just been introduced to this guy who later, after we learn that he's actually a clone, Picard first of all says, alert Starfleet, because I want to know what's going on. And then he goes to talk to him, because Shinzon even mentions the opportunity for peace is too good to turn down, even if they don't believe him at the moment.
But that's such an obvious bait line. Like, the way he says it, you're wondering if the peace is too good to ignore. Like,
Had you been in his situation, and had this not been a clone of you, of course you would have said, forget you and your warship, this is a total lie. But Picard has been totally knocked out of the blue. You mean, this is me? And of course I want to be friendly with me. It's me! So there's your... I want peace. I've been in prison my entire life, and I've been a slave by the Romulans my whole life. I want peace. Okay, I kind of believe what you're saying, but the fact that it's coming from my own mouth makes me believe it. Because anytime I've told myself anything, I believe it.
No, but I don't know. It's hard to imagine what a person would react like looking at themselves. I mean, I would, me personally, and again, just from my own guesstimation about this, if I ran into someone that looked and sounded and was pretending to be me or whatever, that would make me more hesitant, because obviously something bigger is going on here. Why is this person look like me? What is the story here?
My whole life, people have told me that I look a lot like somebody they know or somebody they've seen, and I've seen. You know, before there was a billboard. I lived in this one town, and there was this kind of glam rock clothing store that had a billboard, and the guy on it looked exactly like me, to the point that I thought, did I do that photo shoot? There have been several times in my life when things like this have happened. So having one of those faces that looks like a lot of other people already kind of worries me.
See, but I think there's a difference between having a face that reminds you of a lot of people, and this is supposed to be... There's no doubt this is me, and that's the look that Picard gives. There's no doubt in his mind that this is... I'm looking at a mirror image of myself.
And they figure that out in the next scene talking to Beverly. She says, this is you, down to your strain of shallot syndrome.
But even just looking at him in that scene, before Beverly even confirms it for them, it's like, I am looking at me. There is something wrong with this picture. Like, unless this is a parent trap situation that I didn't know about, like, we're in deep trouble here, and there is something big... And there's something bigger going on. And that would put me more at alert, not less.
Yes. And I would agree with that. And I think Picard agreed with that when he says, alert Starfleet. Like, let them know what's going on, because this is crazy. Then he goes to see what it's about. But first we go down to Romulus, where Shinzon is talking to the other Romulans, who are already kind of questioning his motives. And he pretty much says, get out. And then he talks to Senator T'Lora, right?
Yes. Oh, no. It's not Senator D'Alora anymore. It's Commander D'Natra.
I'm sorry, it's D'Natra. He says to her, you know, look, I need your allegiance. And she even says, do I serve under you? And without hesitation, he says, yes. And you're going to do what I say. She tries to get a little sexy on him, and he says,
why?
Woman, please.
Why?
Yeah.
What was that for? And you get, and you know what? It makes D'Natra look bad, in my opinion, because all of a sudden you get from the impression that you could almost draw the inference that because he turned her down, that's why she turns against him later. Because we see no other. I mean, she has that little speech with that 5-second speech with the other commander later, but we don't see her switch allegiances, and we don't know the
She's
motivation.
She's a power-hungry Romulan who has, at this point, turned her back on the entire civilization of Romulus.
But then why did she turn her back on Shinzon later?
Because she's power-hungry, and she knows in this situation that he's prepared to kill all these other Romulans that he hates, and...
But that's the problem.
And
that's
if she's not going to be able to serve next to him as his sexy love slave, then he's probably going to kill her, and she needs to watch her back.
But that's the problem, is when we get to Shinzon's quote-unquote real motivation, he's not even going after the Romulans. He's not. He would rather sit atop them as their leader than kill the people who enslaved him and tortured him for X number of years.
If you kill all your followers, who are you to be a leader of?
It doesn't matter. The Remans would take over the galaxy. It's Star Trek. I mean, that's what the bad guys do. They take over the Alpha Quadrant. And so it just is so ham-fisted and stupid and doesn't make any sense.
We learn in this scene his partial motivation right here is that something's medically wrong with him. And his Reman advisor, you know, kind of... puts his hand on his chest, and he's, you know, trying to help him out here. And D'Natra kind of sees that here, too, that something's going on with him medically. We're going to learn later on here that because of the cloning process and, you know, the way he was grown, he needs some of Picard's DNA to survive.
Well, then there's another problem with this film, because for someone who has a time crunch, he sure is taking his sweet-ass time. Like, this whole dinner scene goes on forever, and he puts up this whole pretense, which he has no intention of following through. Like, why even bother with the pretense? Just, you have this doomsday weapon. Go!
As Picard wants to know himself, he has lived in a dilithium mine his entire life, and then sees this guy, who he's a clone of, who has become one of the figureheads of the entire Starfleet, and he wants to know what that's about. Tell me how you lived so cool, and tell me about myself, where Picard here is mentioning
where does
to
that
him
go,
a little bit.
Gina?
I'm not you. I can tell you about me.
Where does that go?
Where
Nowhere.
Does that go? That
Nowhere.
Art shows Picard here that it's a what clone of me, yes, but it's not me.
But what does that do for Shinzon?
What it does for Shinzon is tries to get him close. He just wanted to feel him out. And that's the same thing later on when Shinzon wants to look him in the eye when the two ships are battered. It's the same thing. He wants to be the warrior out on the field, and he wants to have statues made of him.
Then what is getting to know Picard, how does that help him?
Because Picard, as the good side of himself, which, you know, is getting along with all the good parts of the universe, is the part of himself that he wants to kill. He is a Reman in his mind, and he wants to take over with the Remans. And living as a Reman, looking like a human, has got to be an insult.
That's some twisted logic, and it doesn't. You explaining it makes it even more twisted. Like I don't get it. I just don't get it. His motivation makes no sense, and he's wasting his time.
It doesn't to me. Yeah.
Okay,
I'm wasting time, you know, as an audience member, trying to watch this boring conversation. I mean, it's not even interesting. It's stuff that I know. It's repeating beats of previous better movies. It's, you know, it's just boring.
But you're not the Star Trek fan this was aimed at. This was aimed at people who knew nothing about Star Trek.
It was? Because it was. You needed to know an awful lot about The Next Generation in order to get some of the stuff about this movie.
Apparently Stuart Baird didn't.
Well, Stuart Baird's an idiot. I mean, like, yeah. And this is being written by a fan.
Ended up with four choices.
And this is being written by a fan who knows Star Trek. So he's writing for fans. He's not writing for the general public. If they were writing for the general public, they would be connecting with this stuff, and they're not.
Okay, well, after this, in Data's quarters, B4 gets a signal. He walks over to a console, and here's your moment. This is what B4 was created for.
Okay, let's re-examine where we've been with B4 at this point, because this doesn't make any sense. So B4 was working for Shinzon this whole time. So Shinzon finds B4 somewhere, reprograms him, disassembles him, puts him on a planet with hostile aliens who could shoot at people at least, and then hopes that the Enterprise will be the one that finds B4 so that they could put him together and download his memory in hopes that he will eventually break onto the Enterprise's computer and report back. That is a lot of, isn't that convenient, and we hope that it works out, and chancy stuff, and it makes no sense. Not one lick of sense, and there's no pretzel that you can twist this into, Gino.
Well, who knows Picard better than himself?
Oh, come on, that's such...
I know, that's not a valid point to make.
That's
I know.
Garbage.
Look, that is a huge plot hole that you have to step over. And
I can't.
I'm not denying it.
I'm falling into the chasm here. Like, this is the point of no return at this point.
Okay, hate it for that if you want, but his plan worked. And
because the crook, because not because it was clever, not because it should work, it's because the script said it should work. That's why it works. And that is infuriating.
Just like Picard, and even the Romulans say, Shinzon is making some lazy choices right here. And he's doing the same thing as Picard is currently doing. They're both kind of going at it blind because they want to know themselves more.
If you say so.
So if his plan hadn't worked, who knows what he would have done? He would have gone straight after the Enterprise and failed. You know, he's got this gigantic warship that can blow them up. Or he would have died because the process would have caught up to him before he got in touch with Jean-Luc Picard. But he made a plan, and it worked. So regardless of how he knew he would be there, it worked.
Because the script says it worked. That's the point I'm trying to get across. It's not because it's clever. It's not because it should work. It's because I'm told it has to work for the story.
And it worked.
But it's working for the wrong reasons. That's what I'm trying to get across from you. It's not because of anything clever. It's not because one thing logically leads to another. It's because the script tells me it's so. And that's poor. That is absolutely poor. And I was thinking about how I would rewrite this movie if I were to do it, if I wanted to keep Shinzon, if I wanted to keep some of the same plot points. I would have Shinzon assassinate the Romulan Senate, just the way he does, take over the Romulan Empire, and start punishing the Romulans. And then what happens is someone in the Romulans, probably through Ambassador Spock's underground network, which is still going on at this point, reaches out to the Federation and says, look, we helped you during the Dominion War. We really need your help on this. This guy is going to annihilate us. This is a mission of mercy. And the Enterprise gets sent out because it's the flagship, and through the course of events, they find out that this person who's spearheading this whole thing is the clone of Picard. And not only is Picard having to save a species from annihilation, he's also having to battle himself in his own battle tactics.
Yeah, and fighting his own nemesis.
And that would have been a much better, more interesting, more compelling story. Cut out B4 entirely, because it adds nothing and does nothing for the story. Yeah. And make that the plot of how Picard guessing what his next move would be.
I think that's brilliant. And I would love to see you make that movie, Matt. But this isn't the movie we got.
No.
We got a movie where up next, Dr. Crusher explains that, I'm sorry, up next, what we get is the Enterprise crew noticing that somebody has accessed the computer. You know, they just don't know who, they don't know where. But at the same time, we also learn that upon the time of the Scimitar decloaking, we found Thaleron radiation, where we get into the talk here about Thaleron and how dangerous it is and how it could have been used in biogenic weapons, and it's illegal for those specific reasons. So
the huge MacGuffin of this movie, this magical cloak.
It's a pretty great cloak. I mean, you have a good ship, of course you kind of have a good cloak.
But I won't harp on it too much because, acknowledging my own biases, I'm okay with red matter in 2009, so I will eat the crap that is Thaleron in this movie and just like it.
Look, it's not midichlorians.
No,
but
it doesn't make the universe turn, but it helps you make a good cloak. And because we don't know anything about it, it's very possible.
It's ironic that both major sci-fi franchises in 2002 are being ruined at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Attack of the Clones, yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
The next thing Gino say is gonna say, I love Attack of the Clones. It's my favorite Star Wars movie.
Oh, are you kidding me? Let's not even get into Star Wars. I'm not going to have that conversation. If you want to talk about Star Trek versus Star Wars, there is a thread on the forum. Go
no, I know.
There.
I'm just saying, that would be your favorite movie.
Jeez, no. Give me Empire any day.
Empire.
Yeah, I agree. But anyway, let's talk about our magical cloak again.
Let's talk back about that magic cloak and how the whole situation with Shinzon is starting to get to Picard, because Crusher comes to his quarters and they're talking about how when Picard was young, he was
apparently bald already, even though we've seen him with hair.
Dude, I'm 28 and I'm getting there. So
no, but what I'm saying
most people my age who are losing their hair just go ahead and shave their head
No. What I'm saying is he's a cadet at the academy when he's bald, and yet when he gets commissioned, he has hair in Tapestry.
Yeah. It's they're treating the viewers like they're idiots. We couldn't possibly imagine that Picard ever had hair when he was 20, 21 years old. So they show this photo of this bald guy that you have to believe that is Picard because he's bald. Come on, people aren't stupid. People know that men have hair when they're young and then they go bald when they're older. We understand that. We see it all of the time. They're treating people like idiots.
Mark, I don't know if you've seen the Red Letter Media review of this movie, and I watched it before for this review.
I haven't, but I'll check it out.
And he talks about the scene, and he says there are two explanations for why this photo shows up the way it does. One, either Picard lost a bet to somebody and had to shave his head, or two, they think the audience is stupid, which is what you just said.
The audience is stupid.
And we won't recognize Captain Picard if he's not bald. Even though, for real fans of this show, which is what they're appealing to, he has an obvious crown of hair throughout the whole run of the series, which means he had hair at some point.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There you go. He was bald. So what?
I guess. I mean, it's not my biggest nitpick of this film. I'll say that.
As things keep going, Geordi and Data have found the source of the unauthorized access to the computer, and they have a way they might be able to take advantage of it. Next, we move to a scene with Troy and Riker.
Okay. I need to address this, because this is something that absolutely just... Not only was I not liking this film, after this point, I actively am despising this film.
And what John Logan had originally intended was for Deanna Troi to have a much bigger part in this movie. In fact, there were two scenes like this, and they cut the second one.
I don't care, because I've seen the second one. I've seen it's supposed to happen in the turbo lift again, right? Mm-hmm. That's the second one.
Yeah.
Look, I get that fans are not usually that fond of Troi. I get that she usually didn't add that much to the stories, even when they was at the series. However, this is your last movie with this crew, and I want these people to have their moments. Crusher, for the most part, is non-existent, and that's sad.
Yeah.
What they do with Troi in having her get mentally raped, and I'm going to use that word, Gino. I know you don't like that word, but it describes the ugliness of this scene. It is so, in my opinion, despicable, disrespectful, misogynistic to do to this character. Deanna Troi in this movie serves one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to get raped. And that is so... Not only is that not Star Trek, it's just... It ruins that. It just absolutely breaks it for me. And that is just... I cannot tell you the anger that the scene makes me feel. I feel bad for Marina Sirtis. I feel bad for Deanna Troi. And I am so sad and heartbroken.
It's supposed to make you hate Shinzon.
It doesn't make me hate Shinzon. Yeah. It makes me hate this movie.
Yeah,
right. That's where it backfired. They're supposed to use this scene to make you hate Shinzon so bad that he would do something so despicable that there's nothing good about him. If there was any question at this point anymore whether or not he actually wanted peace, the answer is a definitive no. And that, my dumb audience, is the point we're trying to make. However, that's not what happened.
I know you like this film, Gino, but do you get where I'm coming from? Like, I absolutely get where you're coming from. I don't like that my last memory of Deanna Troi is her getting raped.
It's a travesty on this planet that women get taken advantage of in any form. And frankly, if I was to come across a situation like that, I would be in prison for ripping a man's head off. But it happened, and Shinzon is a piece of garbage because of the way he's doing this. And this is a situation we encountered before in an episode of TNG with another empath.
Yes, I know, but...
He was telepathic.
I know, and I didn't care for it in that episode, but here it's underlined, and it happens during a private moment, and it's just... Mark, I know you and I are not biggest Deanna Troi fans. I don't mind her that much. I know you don't like her that much, but this is ugly.
It's a terrible way to treat a character. I mean... As a character, Troi was average. She was okay, but she deserves so much more than to be treated like this. In the final movie, like you said, everyone needed to have their moment in the final movie. And like you said, she's just there to be raped, and it's uncomfortable, and I don't like the scene. Does it make me hate Shinzon? Not really. I was never that invested in Shinzon as a character anyway. It just makes me uncomfortable every time I watch this scene.
I mean... To people's point, you could have honestly called this film Star Trek Into Darkness. I mean, this is much more dark than Into Darkness. But
it would have been a little on the nose with the Riemanns living on the dark side of the planet.
I suppose, but so is Nemesis. But yeah. I'm sorry, like, even if it was a character I despised, I would never wish rape upon them.
Okay, well, let's move past that scene, because we got to get through this movie, and there's nothing good about it. And I'm agreeing with you here that nothing good comes from this scene.
And nothing is gained from this scene.
Story-wise, nothing.
Nothing.
What it does is it gets us into the sick bay where they're all worried about Troy, and then Picard gets beamed over to the Scimitar.
But you can't tell me that that's the only way that that Picard could have been kidnapped. Troy did not get any.
It's not. But that's where the scene takes us. And maybe they wanted us to see sickbay and how cool it was and that new tricorder. Or maybe they wanted to put Troy in a very vulnerable situation so that later they can use this back against Shinzon. But granted, they didn't have to go nearly as far as they did. They could have had him probe her mind a little bit and she could have learned right there that she can get into his. Regardless, this is where it brings us. Picard gets transported over to the Scimitar. And here we get Shinzon talking to Picard about, you know, how they're going to take his blood, and this is pretty much where Shinzon shows his hand, and here's a clip.
What is all this about?
It's about destiny, Picard. It's about a Riemann outcast.
You're not Riemann.
And I'm not quite human. So what am I? My life is meaningless as long as you're still alive. What am I while you exist? Shadow? An echo?
If your issues are with me, then deal with me. This has nothing to do with my ship. Nothing to do with the Federation.
Oh, but it does. We will no longer bow before anyone as slaves. Not the Romulans and not your mighty Federation. We are a race bred for war and conquest.
Are you ready to plunge the entire quadrant into war to satisfy your own personal demons?
It amazes me how little you know yourself.
I am incapable of such an act.
You are me! The same noble Picard blood runs through our veins. Had you lived my life, you'd be doing exactly as I am. So look in the mirror. See yourself. Consider that, Captain. I can think of no greater torment for you.
Shinzon? I'm a mirror for you as well.
Not for long, Captain. I'm afraid you won't survive to witness the victory. The echo over the voice.
So, what is the motivation here? First, it was to free the Riemanns.
Yeah.
Then it was to eliminate Picard.
And then it's to take over the galaxy, and then do this, and then do that. What does this guy want? I don't get it.
And then it's because, well, we won't bow to anyone as slaves. Like, what are you saying here? I mean, like, even with terrible villains, like, if you want to call Cybok a villain, I at least knew what Cybok's goal was. I knew what Ruafo's goal was in the last movie.
Yeah, I never understood what this guy actually wanted at all.
I mean, Gino, you won't get this because it's a British show reference, and I don't know how much British TV you want, but Mark, it reminds me a lot of that character from Little Britain. It's a whole bunch of
but no, but see what happened.
That's what this whole
Vicky Pollard. Yeah, but no, yeah, but what I was doing, I was walking around here, and she did this, and I did that, and I was walking around, and you fingered her back of Iceland. Yeah,
that's what this whole it's garbled like that. You see what I mean? It's just that's what it reminds me of, and I. Gino, please explain to me what you thought the motivation was.
What you're looking at here is a bad guy. He wants to take over everything. He wants to be in charge. And if there's somebody, some group, somewhere who's, you know, in charge of something, he wants to rule them. It's a matter of, I've been oppressed my whole life, and I'm going to take it out on everybody else.
But why Picard?
Because Picard is the side of himself that he doesn't want to be. Anytime you hate somebody, it's because most of the time you hate the parts about them that you see in yourself. And that's just what's going on here. A man who's lived an entire life and helped first contact with civilizations and made a family with these people who's all leaving and, you know, he feels kind of empty, as opposed to a man who started with nothing and made a family out of nothing and has lived under torture his entire life, sees this guy who's all sad because his family's going away. I was whipped by Romulans for 10 years.
I don't know. It just feels like the cause of anger is so indirect. And maybe that's what I'm rubbing up against.
That's the point of anger. Anger is always confusing. And even at your maddest in your entire life, have you ever stopped and thought, wow, I'm kind of being a little irrational?
Well, no, but let me try to explain what I mean. Is that okay. I feel that I get what you're saying, but Picard, through no actions of his own, contributed to any of Shin's unsuffering. The only suffering he contributed to is by existing for him to be created, which he wouldn't be around in the first place if it wasn't for Picard anyway. Mm. Now, in the movie that I compare this to, which is Star Trek II, you could say that Khan's anger at Kirk is equally as misplaced, but Kirk had a direct, through his own actions, led to the suffering that Khan endured, because Kirk left him on that planet.
And was he blamed him for the death of his wife. There was a genuine reason why Khan hated Kirk.
And he stranded
him on Seti Alpha 5, and he blamed him for the death of his wife.
I mean, here, like, Picard does nothing but exist. And I get what you're saying, Gino, but that it's that lack of any sort of direct connotation or direct action that is not gelling for me.
Okay, well, look at it this way. Shinzon was created to take Picard's place. And that didn't happen. Instead of following this grand destiny that he was purposed for, he was tossed aside like garbage and left to die.
But that's not Picard's fault.
That's not Picard's fault, no. But if you're told from the time you're born, this is what you're meant to do, and then just forget about it, you don't matter anymore, there's still going to be a part of you that says, I need to complete this destiny.
Well, then I still don't understand why he wants to rule over the Romulans and not kill them. Because if it were me in that situation, I would be like, who has the power now, bitches?
He wants to watch them suffer. He doesn't want to watch them die. I mean, they're dead. They're gone. The end. What, do I get to go live under a tree for the rest of my life?
But they're not suffering. Some of them are working with him. Like, I wouldn't have any Romulans working with
me. They're working for him. They're not working with him.
But it doesn't matter.
He's cracking the whip on them every opportunity he gets.
But he's not making them suffer. He's not making them suffer.
He doesn't have the power to make them suffer yet.
But he does! He has this doomsday weapon that he could let loose anywhere.
Yeah, but let's say he started firing right now. Then the Federation, who's already been in league with the Romulans during the Dominion War, would just pair up and get rid of this guy. Granted, probably great cost due to the power of the ship, but it wouldn't take long.
No, but it wouldn't take long, but I think of it as like this. We talk about, I don't want to bring in this in too much, but we're talking about how this is happening around the same time as September 11th, correct?
Right.
Those terrorists knew that they were going to die. They knew that this was a suicide mission. But the point is, by doing what they did, they made their statement. And I think that if Shinzon really wanted to get his revenge against those who actually wronged him, he would start killing off sections of Romulus. And even though he would be stopped eventually, by the time he's killed and stopped, so many Romulans would be dead that he would have made his statement. I mean, he killed off the leading body of Romulus.
His statement would have been made, but it would have come to an end. The difference between those terrorists is they died for an ideal. And you can't fight terrorism, because that's like fighting evil. It's never going to go away. It's the dark side of our personalities. If one guy wants to be one guy and kill everybody else, you kill the one guy, bad guy problem over.
No, but by that point, like his message has, because I don't take it that he has the whole of population of Remus with him.
Oh, apparently not. And from all we know of these Remans, really, is that they're, you know, cheap.
So that even if he were to die, his statement has been made, and Remus, the relation between Remus and Romulus is not going to be the same. You're going to have a major
yes,
revolt.
But I highly doubt the Remans could have had an uprising at this point.
Why not?
Had Shinzon died, apparently the only ship they have in their fleet is the Scimitar.
Well, apparently they got that ship out of nowhere, so why not replicate the process?
Because you don't have a leader like Shinzon. All these Remans are is sheep at this point.
Well, regardless, I don't mean to like take this into... This is going to be a long podcast, but...
Yeah,
the
sorry.
Point I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make here is that I'm not getting it. In every other Star Trek movie, I know what they want. Even if I don't like them, even if I think their goal is stupid, I know what they want. And
that's the thing that confuses me about this movie. I don't know why Shinzon is there. What is he supposed to be doing? What does he want? Why was he put into this movie? I just don't get it.
And, you know, I think...
If you want to make the parallel with the September 11th attacks, it's... At this point, we were still kind of standing with our hands on our heads going, why? You know, what did we do to you? And
no, but I get why... I don't agree with it, obviously, but I get why they did what they did.
Yeah, but in 2002, we didn't.
Yeah. All right, but
we were still just kind of wounded.
I guess, but... I don't know. I'm just saying in science fiction, in storytelling, I need some sort of motivation. And a good villain engenders some sympathy from me. I mean, they did that, I think, brilliantly, and they play with your expectations in Star Trek Into Darkness because we Star Trek fans know who Khan is. We don't want to like Khan.
Yeah.
But there was a period there where, like, I get him. Like,
yeah, there were times in that movie, and I think Benedict Cumberbatch had said beforehand that you will feel some sympathy, and there were points in the movie the first time I watched it, and I thought, I can understand where this guy's coming from. I can sympathize with him. And there were times when I thought, actually, maybe he's not going to be evil Khan, and then obviously he ends up to be. But there was a moment when I thought, maybe this guy's going to be okay.
But see, that battle raged on in my mind, like, this is Khan. What am I talking about? Of course he's not supposed to be good, but I'm finding him good. Like, and same thing happened with Nero. Nero's more of an evil villain, but, like, I get why Nero's upset. And I get why Nero's upset specifically at Spock and the Federation. It's because you were supposed to help us. You said you could help us. So, you know, I understand it. In this one, not only has he committed rape, not only do I not understand him, I find him petulant. Like he reminds me of a overgrown crybaby at some of this motivation stuff, and I have no sympathy for him.
Okay, well, we're doing the he attacked us, let's go get him kind of plot here.
Yeah.
So. What they're saying is there's no reason for you to feel sympathy with a villain. And
that's
a
mistake.
When it comes down to great villains in movies, Shinzon isn't one of them. I mean, you would talk about General Zod in The New Man of Steel. Wonderful motivation. He's trying to save and preserve his planet. Spoilers if you haven't seen that one. But I will agree with you. Shinzon is not the best villain. But I'm still entertained. Because I get to see the Enterprise crew go to war. And if it's a matter of I don't feel sympathy for this bad guy, that means when they kill him, I'm not going to feel bad one bit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And if that's what gets you going in this movie, I'm glad you get something out of it, Gene. I'm not trying to take that away from you.
I don't think you are. And you're making great points. And there have already been points right now where I've thought, you know, Matt's absolutely right. Maybe this isn't the best movie that was ever made, but I'm having a good time. And it's good to see people who I've essentially grown up with looking good and doing cool things.
I mean, yeah, I get that. But what I'm saying is when you want to just eliminate the bad guy and have no sympathy for him, to me it loses an emotional component that I wish was there and is present in what I consider a good Star Trek.
I think what they're trying to hold on to here and still kind of keep that line out in the water for you is that it's still kind of Picard.
But and, I don't. But see, I'm not even going with that at this point. So you know, they're not winning.
Let me break that down here, because right here is when you know, you learn that B4 was in with Shinzon. You know, Shinzon treats him like crap, tells him to leave. He comes back after the scene we just had the clip of, and he's like, Shinzon needs to see the prisoner. You find out it's Data, who does the Vulcan neck pinch on the Reman.
Which is consistent because he does the Vulcan neck pinch in Unification.
Right. You know, and so we found out, hey, you know, this is the plan that Geordi and Data were talking about earlier when they said they, you know, found a way to take advantage of whoever was getting information off of the ship. It's safe to assume that they either, well, no, they even explain after this that they played with the information that they downloaded to B4 so that it was wrong. So that when they got the information over there, I guess it was Data at that point, when they got Data over there and downloaded information, it was incorrect information. Data and Picard go to break out of the ship. They have some corridor fight scenes with some Reemans. Yes, I'm going to ignore the fact that they're facing away from the Reemans who shoot at them and miss. Then
it's a classic Stormtrooper battle, isn't
right?
it?
Right. Yeah.
They break into a shuttle bay where we see some Scorpion fighters. That's where they're introduced, and they, if you play Star Trek Online, they really come in handy. But yes, they shoot this bay door out, and they get back to the Enterprise. And that's another little moment of Picard and Data taking things over together, and we're going to get out of this together, especially because Data hands Picard this emergency transport device that Geordi made for him, and he even says, we're going to get off the ship together.
Telegraph, pay attention to this moment, people. That's what the scene is saying.
Well, this would have been the second moment had they not left out the earlier meeting between Picard and Data after the wedding.
Yeah,
so it kind of sullies that. This is more foreshadowing than it is strengthening their relationship.
I mean, even when you watch, I just want to point out the telegraphing, because even when you watch Wrath of Khan, when I first watched that movie, I didn't know Spock was going to die. Like, they did a good job of waiting to play that card till the scene it was going to happen. You know, and thereby the emotional impact of that death is so powerful. And, you know, you're just in tears watching them say goodbye to each other. Here, they're like, well, here's another piece of the puzzle. And here's another piece of the puzzle. And when you put all these jigsaw pieces by the end, it means Data's dead.
That's a crappy puzzle. I'm sorry, not to break apart my own point, but you're putting a puzzle together and it's of Data dying?
But you know what I'm talking about.
No, and I'm solidifying your point by saying that. So, yeah, you're making absolute sense here. And I'm sorry that it had to turn out that way. But damn it, Brent Spiner, if you're trying to kill Data off, do it right.
Yeah.
Anyway, things move along. We have a staff meeting where LaForge calls Shinzon's weapon a cascading biogenic pulse, that the properties of Thaleron radiation allow the weapon to expand its radius enough to affect a ship or even a planet. So, Thaleron radiation is bad.
Genesis 2.0.
Okay.
Yeah.
They also mentioned that Shinzon has the magical cloak, that the cloak of invisibility, if you will.
The Shinzon, most perfect cloak ever designed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Shinzon and the magical technicolor magic cloak.
Well, it also gets pointed out here by Beverly that because of the genetic situation that Shinzon is in, he needs to come after Picard before he goes after Earth.
But he does a lot to try to make sure that Picard dies before he can get to him.
He does. He kind of flip-flops after a little bit, because as things go on here and...
He flip-flops at the beginning, because if he left before to get collected on that planet, who's to say that Picard wouldn't have gotten shot by those aliens?
Picard's resourceful, whatever.
But you see what I mean? Like, you have to pray that a lot of things go right for this plan to work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's not the smartest villain. I mean, he's pretty presumptuous. He was.
But he should be the smartest villain because he's a clone of Picard. He should be a smart villain.
Yeah, Picard's supposed to be this brilliant tactician.
If they wanted to make him exactly like Picard, he would have sounded a lot more like Picard and looked more like him.
But that's the whole point of the movie, Gino! We're supposed to believe that this is Picard.
Yeah, well, it's not.
Okay, at least I get you to say it. Like.
Yeah. Well, things for Shinzon are going well. He's got about 7 minutes before they reach the rift. Now, what are they talking about, the rift? And we find out that Shinzon's ship has been following the Enterprise E ever since they took off when Picard and Data broke out. So they're right on them. And then Picard goes and meets with Data in Astrometrics.
Data, what's our current position? As soon until we reach the fleet.
At our current velocity, we will arrive at Sector 1045 in approximately 40 minutes, sir.
For now, we see but through a glass darkly.
Sir?
He said he's a mirror.
Of you, sir?
Yes.
I do not agree. Although you share the same genetic structure, the events of your life have created a unique individual.
If I had lived his life, is it possible that I would have rejected my humanity?
The B4 is physically identical to me, although his neural pathways are not as advanced. But even if they were, he would not be me.
How can you be sure?
I aspire, sir, to be better than I am. B4 does not, nor does Shinzon. We are passing through the Basin Rift, sir. The projection will return when we have cleared.
It's interfering with our uplink from starting to talk.
The rift affects all long-range communication.
Squadron Riker, evasive maneuvers.
And here you get your action scene. They're going to plop this in right here. Go on, Matt.
Gino, just to show you that I'm not a complete a-hole about this movie, minus the scene that got deleted, which is absolutely my favorite scene and should have been in this movie. Of the scenes that are actually in this movie, this little scene in stellar cartography I could probably identify as my favorite, and I don't know about you, Mark, but it reminds me of what the character moments that this movie should have had and needed to have. And it's good, but it's a two-minute scene, and it should have been a movie full of this stuff, especially the end movie.
It was supposed to have been evenly spaced like that, starting from the start of the wedding, and
I think that's what I think that's what you can say about this movie. What should have been? It was supposed to have been.
What this movie could have been is much better than what it was. I'll give you that.
And you know what, Gino? That also makes it more disappointing, at least in my perspective, because say you have Star Trek V, an idea that sounds like crap from the get-go. I mean, when you think about the Enterprise,
no redeeming features.
The Enterprise goes off to meet God. Like, how is there's no good outcome for that story, at least in my opinion. What makes this more disappointing is, like, there's a good story in here somewhere. It wants to be a good story. It is trying so hard to be a good story. And when you end up with a good story that gets ruined in what could have been, to me that's almost worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is no Tapestry. I'm going to say that. It was enjoyable, though. And there are several plot holes, and there are several things that this movie fails on. And I'm sorry it had to be that way. But...
No, you don't have to apologize for this movie.
Just saying, when you look at what Next Generation was when it started, when they were wearing smelly spandex suits and things weren't really sure where they would go, in the second episode they fight space Africans, then you move on to what it eventually became. And it fell flat. It did. And this movie had such a great premise to begin with. I mean, you've got somebody whose greatest villain turns out to be themselves. I mean,
that is a really cool idea.
You've got the moment from when Janeway talks to him and she's like, you fought the Borg, which were the biggest problem. You fought the Sona, which were kind of a huge problem, but Insurrection sucked. You've got all these other things that have been terrible, but... Now you're fighting your greatest enemy. She said that.
And the pitch of this movie, when you just break it down to just the pitch, sounds awesome. Give me that movie, because this movie ain't that movie.
I think I still ride on the high of that. I think I love this movie more than what it was. I mean, have you ever had an ugly dog?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that dog might be butt ugly and might bite all of your friends, but damn it, you love the dog. And it's kind of the same thing that I'm going to stand behind this movie no matter how logically and seriously you break it down for me. Because there are some points that you've already made that I'm like, crap, he's right. How am I going to defend myself? And it's like, what should I defend? I love Star Trek. And I'm not saying this quantifies Star Trek in any way. But
no, and I get that. You're perfectly within your right, Gino, as a Star Trek fan, to love this movie. I'm, like I said, I'm not trying to take that away from you. What I'm trying to explain to you is why I don't like it.
Oh, yeah. And already you've, like I've said, you're making great points. This is, I wanted to give it all to the writing and say it was just poor directing, but yeah, it was kind of poorly written here, too.
And so not to mention, in this scene, it's like, the thing that I don't like about this scene is that, okay, we're at maximum warp and we're going to meet this fleet, which mm-hmm. is going to take an amount of time. One, wouldn't it be easier if both ships, the Enterprise and the fleet, were traveling toward each other? We can meet up much sooner. Just saying.
hey, you know ship is two-dimensional. Not ship, space. That's what I meant. Space.
Even still, if space is two-dimensional, if two trains are traveling at warp 9, how soon can they meet each other? Like, you know, it's one of those things. It's just...
yeah.
But second of all, it's kind of, again, telegraphing, and again, I chalk this up to poor writing. We're going to pass through this rift where sensors and communication and long range, all this stuff is going to be offline. Gee, I wonder where we're going to be ambushed on the way back home.
Yeah. Well, this is where we get, I don't want to say obligatory action scene, but this is where we get the space battle. And one of the things in the space battle is actually what John Logan wanted when he was originally thinking about the premise of this movie. The main thing he wanted was to have the Enterprise roll over and fire from the bottom. And that's just what happens after the Scimitar catches up to him, fires out of the cloak, they fire some phasers back, barely hit him, miss with the torpedoes. The Scimitar starts taking out their dorsal shield, so they flip over, and still no good. They make a callback to Kirk here, and Riker says they're going to use defensive pattern Kirk Epsilon, and they call Troy to the bridge. But just then, Shinzon hails and wants to see Picard in his ready room. And I'm like, what? Did he transport over there? That's stupid to transport over to his ship. What a dumb move. And then you find out, oh, this is a hologram. How suave of, I want to say, evil Picard. Because Picard is always, come into my ready room and talk to me, because I'm going to sit here and you're going to present your ideas to me, and Mr. Worf, I'm going to tell you why you suck, or one thing or another. But in this situation, it's Shinzon, who is, for lack of better words, evil Picard, doing the same thing to Picard.
Yeah. It's a nice parallel. Yeah.
Kind of, but this scene in the ready room, in addition to the scene where Picard is being restrained on Shinzon's ship, it wants to be poignant, and I see a semblance of poignancy in it, but ultimately it plays out like, ah, Mr. Bond, here, let me tell you my crazy-ass plan, and while I sit around and, you know...
Stroke my white cat.
I will agree with you again that this villain needs a better motivation. And without that, he's just a bad guy doing bad guy things.
I mean,
the problem will go away when he dies.
Gino, this is hilarious. But like, if you have a good sense of humor about this movie, you can hear someone tear it apart. The Red Letter Media review of this movie says a lot. Like, there's a point where he starts comparing the way Shinzon looks and acts to Dr. Evil from the Austin Powers movies, and it's freaking hilarious. And now when I watch this movie, I can't see anybody but Dr. Evil, who is equally as poorly motivated as Shinzon, but at least for there, it's for comedy.
All right, give me just one second here. I'm trying to catch up on my notes.
He's a bit like the... is it the Claw from Inspector Gadget?
Yes.
Dr. Claw.
Dr. Claw.
Just sits there stroking the white cat.
I'll get you next time, Gadget.
There
next
is a time. But we've already had some clips back and forth. So I'm just going to
skip it. We can insert it later.
Yeah, Melissa, if you want to throw this in while editing, there is a clip of these two in the ready room.
And can I just bring up another point about this movie that kind of threw me off guard from, and I haven't mentioned it up until this point. It's especially highlighted in this scene here in the ready room and in the staff meeting in where Picard calls battle stations. Man, the crew looks tired. The actors look tired. And they look
old.
And they look like...
I'm tired.
I mean, to quote, to not be censored or anything, but to quote, you know, Murtaugh from Lethal Weapon, they all say, I'm getting too old for this, you know what.
Well, and, there's that, and you're dealing with a director that nobody wants to work for, and I don't want to talk badly about this cast that I admire.
I'm not talking badly about the cast.
No, but what I'm saying is they're all kind of saying, look, I've been doing this for 15 years, and you don't know crap about Star Trek, and Baird's coming back. Well, you're going to do it anyway. So they're saying, I guess we'll make this stupid movie, and I'll make my couple $1 million.
But you know what I mean? Like, screw especially, it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're Chakotay-ing this movie.
They are, and the problem that, like, for example, we just did the Christmas special, all of us did, and Gino, you play Riker, and Riker always speaks with gusto, and he's the adventure guy, and he's the action guy, and he's the let's do it guy. In this movie, Jonathan Frakes is whispering all of his lines.
He doesn't want to be anywhere but married. He wanted to go to Beta Zed, strip off his clothes, get together with Troy, and leave.
But you know what I mean? It's like
take over his own, finally take command of his own ship, and then sail off into the sunset.
But it's robbing me of what I liked about Riker. And this movie's job, as the last film in the franchise, is to remind me, why did I enjoy taking the journey with these characters for the last 15 years? Why did I invest so much time, so much energy, so much emotion into these characters' lives? And it's not doing that. It's reminding me, instead of showing me, well, these guys need to get off the screen because they're ready for the retirement home with the way they're acting.
Well, let's move forward because I'm agreeing with your point here. So what happens now is basically that scene in the ready room tells Picard, I'm going to have to kill Shinzon. There's nothing else here. There's no getting through to him. So just then, Denatra shows up and says, hey guys, I flip-flopped, and I'm here to help you out.
How, by the way, does she show up? Like, here's the thing. Like, she had to have known that this is exactly where the Enterprise would get ambushed, because you can't tell me that she's following Shinzon, because Shinzon is traveling with his magic cloak turned on. If the Federation can't track it, the Romulans can't track it either.
Is she tracking the Enterprise?
But what I'm saying is she would have to... No, because the Enterprise left first. And unless she was right there with them...
she's already been spurned by Shinzon at this point.
No, she's...
Probably looking for her opportunity to make a move.
Okay, but she's not, because after the Enterprise leaves is when you get that scene of her with the other Romulan guy.
Okay,
the other Romulan guy where saying... he's planning its annihilation, and this will mark our children for centuries. That's after the Enterprise leaves.
Okay.
So...
I don't want to say what-ifs too much, but let's speculate that there could have been a Tal Shiar agent on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
I suppose.
The ship is really cool, huh?
Yeah.
I love the ship. Okay, another...
I've always been a big fan of Romulan ships. I love the original TOS Romulan Warbirds. I love the D-Deridex ships, and I love this ship. This is awesome.
That's another point I'll give you, Gino. New Romulan Warbirds are cool. I really like this design.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, the props department did not fail in this movie.
No, and the thing that I like about it is that the symbol of the Romulan Empire has always been the hawk, and these ships actually look like hawks.
Yeah.
Finally.
So, when Denatra shows up, they get into a bigger space battle, and... I gotta hand it to Shinzon, as far as, like, doing clever things. He has them decloak part of the ship to make it look like they've injured the cloak somehow, and they fire on him thinking that he's, thinking that he's damaged or whatever, and he uses that to his advantage to take out Denatra. Kind of.
Kind of, and it's clever, but I have my problem with this whole... How long is this final battle? Because it is a really long scene, and therein lies the problem. Because,
but if you're going to cut other scenes to make time for the deleted scenes, they arguably should have cut the stuff with the Argo. I'll give you that there. But we have not had any space battles in this movie yet.
I realize that, but in Star Trek, it, you know, and even in Deep Space Nine, where it was nothing but space battles with the Dominion War, it was never, this has to be at least half an hour of this movie, where it's nothing but action, 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 action. And that's tiring.
It's action, 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 but it doesn't hold my interest.
We're just firing phasers and torpedoes for 30 minutes. And, you know, compare this to Wrath of Khan, right? Where there's a battle at the beginning where they meet up with Khan, and then they go away. There's a battle, then they meet up in the nebula again, they fight for a little bit, and then they go away. And they catch up with each other again, and then go away. Like, there's moments of suspense, there's moments of tension, and here it's just moving, 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 moving. It's what people accuse the J.J. movies of being, but the J.J. movies are broken up. If you actually time them, they pause from their action to fill in with a nice character moment, to give us some suspense. It's not this sustained, long action scene. This has to be one of the longest in Star Trek, and it just gets tiring.
Okay, so what happens next is that this opportunity is a great time for Troi to take her violation to an advantage. And she gets back to the Viceroy and guides Worf's hand, like Patrick Swayze in Ghost, to fire the photon torpedoes at the scimitar.
Yeah, what is she doing exactly? Does she have her mental powers hooked into the computer or something? Like, I don't know what's going on, but...
she contacted the Reman.
Yes,
the Reman,
I know that.
Finds out where he is. And just by that, she knows, okay, he's here, so I'm going to say point
position,
there.
And she's able to point Worf's hand and, yep, say, yeah, fire at that particular position.
Yeah,
I guess. Okay, I guess.
It's good.
I'm kind of surprised you have a problem with that. I mean, that's a small thing that Star Trek has done before.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I'll give you that. Forget that I said it, but again, I just want to emphasize the point. This does not make an excusable payoff for what they put Troi through this movie. This is not...
And by the end of this scene, there's another character that doesn't get a good payoff, and I'll get there in just a second. So, this all happens. We fire upon the scimitar, and the magic cloak is down. We fire some more stuff at it, and now Shinzon's like, forget it, just board the Enterprise and get Picard. That's all I really care about. I don't want to blow up the ship, just get Picard.
Which, again, I want to point out, if that's all you care about, how does he know that the bridge is not exploding each time he tries to fire on them? And
he said focus on, you know, weapons and shields.
Yes, I know, but you know perfectly as well as I do that even when Star Trek ships get hit, consoles explode. Like, how does he know that Picard is not dead already, but through his own stupid actions?
Well, whether or not, he's going to go find out. So, they're getting a boarding party over there, and Worf and Riker and some other peeps are going to meet this boarding party.
Okay, why Riker? Why Riker? Riker's never...
Because Riker's a big guy. He's good hand-to-hand.
I know that, but he in a battle like this, if Picard does get injured, Riker needs to be there in the bridge to take command.
Okay, well, here's the thing. As Riker and Worf are walking to meet this party, walking, by the way, come on, Worf turns to Riker and says the Romulans fought with honor. And that scene was supposed to be monumental. And here, I'm going to let Larry say it, because he puts it in much better words than I would.
Okay.
Okay.
One of the moments that I read in the script that I thought was sad to see what happened on film, that I thought was very cool, and I know was part of John Logan's intention, was when you've got a TV ensemble and they go to the movie and somebody's got to be lead, somebody's going to be second, some of the characters get short shrift. And probably through most of the movies, most of the time, that wound up being like Dr. Crusher and Geordi and Worf, even aside from Worf's scene at the beginning of First Contact. And this script kind of the same way. But there was a moment after they've boarded, after the Remans have boarded Enterprise, and they're about to have the fight in the world's largest Jeffries tube. And they're walking along, and it's after the Romulan ships. Oh, and all the cool ships in this show were great too. After they had the fight, and the Romulans all sacrificed themselves, basically, they didn't intend to, but they all get wiped out. And Riker and Worf are walking along a corridor. And I remember reading this on the page because it just pops up out of nowhere. And I went, oh, and it just hit me on like five levels. But it's the moment when they're walking along and Worf's thinking to himself, and then he He thinks out loud in Riker's direction, and he says, "The Romulans fought with honor." And that's all he says. Mm-hmm. And Riker kind of nods or says, "Yes, they do." And googie me, I'm reading along, and that means if you were a moviegoer and saw that line, you'd go, "Okay, fine, whatever." And if you weren't a fan, you'd say, "Okay." But if you were a fan and you remember, here's a character that didn't get much of an arc in this movie, but here's John Logan trying to give him a moment that goes all the way back to the third season episode where Geordi's in the pit. Trapped in the pit, and Worf is on board, and they've got a captured Romulan, and Dr. Crusher and Picard want Worf to donate some blood plasma because it's the only thing they've got will save this Romulan, and Worf refuses to, and they let the Romulan die. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, it established Worf's whole, "I hate the Romulans," and you find out about the Kittimer Massacre and all that, and it's just too much of him. So that's total backstory. None of that gets referenced in this movie. But when I'm reading the script and flipping along on top of everything else going on, and it's just them walking down that corridor, and out of the blue, seemingly, Worf says, "The Romulans fought with honor." And Riker kind of looks at him and nods, and they don't go on with anything else. I thought that was the coolest damn moment. Not that I'm a huge Worf fan, but it is, because you had to be a fan to know what those five words meant to Worf. It's like that could have been the end of a whole character arc of 15 years right there. And I also thought on another level, it's like, what power that someone who knows the franchise and knows the characters well enough to write that little moment in there. It's like, I'm sorry, Michael. I'm sorry, Worf. I couldn't fit in a bigger part for you, but I'm going to do this one little moment here. I hope everybody's smart enough to get it, because I know there's at least a chunk of fandom that will get it. Because me sitting there reading that script got it. And then I watched the movie, and it's like they're out taking the dogs for a walk. Oh, the Romulans fought with... I mean, the way it was staged and played and everything, and I went... Okay. I mean, it was like that about the ships colliding and about just an awful lot of pieces. It was like, okay, well, that was kind of lost in the jumble of what was obvious and what, you know, in the hands of somebody, in the hands of Jonathan directing, I don't think that would have happened.
That's really what it comes down to, I think, is
I'm
direction.
I'm in 100% agreement with him, because that line, he's right. On paper, that should be monumental. Yeah. On paper, that should be monumental, and it should play that way, because he's right, especially with that episode that he talked about, The Enemy, which is 5 stars. I love that episode.
Yeah, great episode.
I love that he said it's just like taking the dogs out for a walk, though.
It is. Yeah. The way it's delivered in the movie and the way it's handled, it has all the emotional impact of nice weather we're having. Yes, we are.
It's completely throwaway line. Yeah.
Let's keep walking.
And let's not take any time to reflect on this, because as soon as Riker says, yes, they are, that's when they find the Remans. And if Riker and Worf are taking their sweet-ass time to find the Remans, so are the Remans trying to take their time finding Picard, because they're just marching through the corridor like nothing.
Yeah, well, they have their big, you know, on-screen fight scene, and there's people just punching each other and all sorts of wildness and firefights and whatnot. And then you get kind of the number two boss fight. Of course the Viceroy had to fight Riker, didn't he?
Did he have to? I guess to get emotionally satisfying, but then again, this again plays into, you've been showing me these characters which are tired and old throughout this whole episode, and now you want me to believe that Riker can be an action hero and have a fist fight and win?
Well, we don't have to deal with that for too long, because just then the scimitar fires on the bridge and the view screen explodes and guys get sucked out into space. I mean, you can hate on this movie all day long, but I'm sure you have to admit that was a cool scene.
When I was 14 years old watching this in the theater for the first time, that was my favorite scene, is watching the view screen just explode, because we hadn't seen that in any Star Trek. That's never happened. No.
And, you know, you always think it would, because the bridge is just a little bubble on top of the
and it's sitting right on top. Like
It should be the first point. Yeah.
If the shields go down.
Anyone takes, yeah.
If the shields go down, now, again, not to compare movies and not to say, oh, this one's so much better, but this was good. It was cool. The way it happens in Star Trek 2009 at the beginning when that woman gets sucked out and all the sound cuts out is better.
Yeah.
But this is still cool. Yeah. I still like this, but they improve upon their model, I think.
So, people hang on. You know, the emergency force field goes up, and then Picard calls for a medical team Troy races over and takes the ops position. And this is where some people kind of call this an in-joke, because she was at the helm when the saucer section crashed on...
It's supposed to be an in-joke. It's supposed to be an in-joke, and I have no doubt that that's what they're referencing. I don't... But I'm one of those weird fans that never blame Troy for crashing the Enterprise.
She didn't crash the ship.
She didn't crash the Generations, and she was at the helm taking Picard's orders.
Oh, yeah. This one is even more excusable because
she
Picard tells
her
to...
She did her best to save the ship.
Yeah.
She saved that ship.
But in this one, Picard tells her to run into the ship. And that's
how does he do it, too?
Text message.
Brilliant! You mean we don't have to speak everything? I mean, when you look at the things that Star Trek has given us versus what we've taken out of it, we've got iPads, we've got, 3D printers are becoming replicators. I mean, people are working on holodecks all the time, but talking to the computer, not something we really care about.
I have a question for you guys, and it's something that I need answered, because I didn't have my first cell phone until I was in high school, and this movie came out when I was in 8th grade. So I didn't have a cell phone yet. I didn't know where we were in terms of technology, but had text messaging become a thing in 2002, or was that later?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, here in the UK, text messaging, we were actually quite a way ahead of you guys. So text messaging, the first text message was sent in, just before Christmas 92. So at least in this country, text messaging was huge. You guys had pagers in the US, didn't you? Pagers never made it. Pagers never made it here. We went straight onto digital cell phone networks, as you'd call them.
Lucky civilization.
I mean, Gina, do you remember? Because I don't remember text messaging, my own memory of it.
And I was late to the cell phone game.
See, but that another reason why the UK is always ahead of us. But I don't remember text messaging becoming a mainstream thing until like the mid-2000s here. That's just my memory of it. But.
Wow. That was the time when it started to die here. Text messaging's gone, all the kids are using WhatsApp and things like that.
Huh. I guess that's a good way to see what our future looks like. Everybody.
So I guess Star Trek in this instance is one step ahead and one step behind the game. Because I don't remember texting being a thing for us, but it clearly was for the rest of the world, so.
Okay, so we use this text message, and Picard has Troy slam the Enterprise E into the Scimitar. Now, the way Josh Logan wanted this to be, he wanted this to be, just even the sound of it, to be almost heartbreaking, because one, the E is still kind of new. We've only seen it in one other movie.
Two other movies.
Two others? Okay.
Two, yeah.
First Contact and Insurrection.
But it hasn't been around as long as the D was.
No.
It's still a relatively shiny ship. I mean, it's got that new starship smell.
And did you notice, guys, I don't know if you noticed, but did they redesign that a little bit for this movie? Because it looks sleeker in this film.
I think it did have a few tweaks. Yeah, here and there, a few.
They actually added more blue to. They changed up some of the carpet, some of the consoles.
I noticed that, but I'm talking about the outside looks sleeker.
Yeah,
it very well could have as well.
Yeah.
So this scene was supposed to be just brutal. Just these two ships slam together, and then they screech apart. Larry in the interview even said it's like pulling a fish hook out of your hand. It's supposed to be just brutal, and the way it came off was kind of disappointing. And when you see these two ships slamming together, the Enterprise is pretty crippled. After this, Shinzon orders his ship to go full reverse and pulls away from the Enterprise. And though they're both damaged more from this, it seems like Shinzon's ship isn't as crippled as they would have wanted it to be.
No, all that really happens to Shinzon's ship is all this does is take his weapons offline. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. The Enterprise is in much worse shape because of this. I mean, its whole forward section is gone. I certainly hope that Picard sent a text message to those decks to evacuate before he decided to ram the ship.
Yeah.
But how'd you like that? Just to be Edson No Name working in the forward sections of the hull, and I'm like, they're just looking out the window, and like,
that's
getting awful
coming
close.
Awfully close.
What's that? What's oh my lord?
Oh jeez. Oh man. Well, during that whole incursion, Riker wins the fist fight, and Shinzon pulls his ship away, and Picard orders the auto destruct. And it doesn't work.
To which so many reviews have pointed out, including Red Letter Media, they're like, psst, you know you could just go down and shoot the warp core. But that's okay. I won't tell them that you're a coward, too. But, you know, it's just, why at this point? Like, Picard tries to set the self-destruct after the ships have pulled apart, right?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't that be something you try to do as they're connected? Because if they're connected and the Enterprise goes, then
they'll take anything that's close,
Yeah,
I don't know if that had been part of the plan, and Shinzon just kind of got the drop on him there and pulled away. But Shinzon goes to activate his Thaleron Matrix, the weapon that's going to destroy everything. He doesn't even care about Picard now.
So, apparently not, even though he's dying and won't get to accomplish his goal of getting Earth.
Yeah, that's going to be the end of Shinzon. Well, in order to take it out, somebody needs to go over there. Picard says, I'll do it. Data says, no, let me do it. Picard says, I have to do this. And he transports over just as the transporters break, so nobody else can follow him. Data's in charge now, and as soon as Picard leaves, Data's like, Geordi, come with me. And doesn't he put Troy in charge?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so he puts Troy in charge. He's like, come with me, and he does the ship-to-ship jump, which... When you're talking about what movie did it better, I think Into Darkness did it a little bit better, the way they kind of launch out of the bay because of the pressure. Yes. And wasn't Geordi kind of standing in the same hallway when he took the force field down?
No, but I will give them this, because Geordi stands in the hallway, puts a force field up in front of him,
okay,
and then takes the force field down in front of Data.
Yeah, it's like an airlock, yeah.
So, not comparing movies anymore, Data hops over. And by the time he gets over there, Picard and Shinzon have been kind of fighting it out. And as Shinzon goes to make, like, this last-minute overhand, really telegraphed knife to Picard, Picard pulls, a bar out of the wall and causes Shinzon to run himself through.
Walks himself through. I mean, you could see him. He impales himself on that thing, because I would have understood if, like, Shinzon was, like, running with the knife up and runs into the thing, but he walks into it.
He had only gotten, like, two steps.
And then pulls himself through. It's quite a gruesome scene.
Like, how fast was he going to go all the way through himself at that point? Yeah. But, yes, then he just pulls himself over to Picard, and kind of proves himself to be this weird animal thing that wasn't exactly human.
Yeah.
But he, you know, pretty much says to Picard, you know, after all that, we're going to die together. How perfect for our destiny is to end this way. Shinzon dies. Data shows up. And Picard is completely stunned. So Data attaches the emergency transport mechanism to Picard.
Now, I have a question about this, because in my rewatching of this, are we to understand that this thing is a transporter in itself? Because I thought it was just a transponder.
I thought it was a transponder, yeah. An emergency signaling device of some kind.
I thought it was like one of those things where you slap it on a person, and even if you can't detect where they are, this will send out a signal like a pattern enhancer.
Yeah.
And it makes it easier to lock on. Oh, but the transporters are offline at this point, so what would we assume?
I was going to compare it to the tags that they use in Insurrection, but those were just transponders.
Mm.
So, yeah. I had never even thought about that before, yeah. Good thinking. So, okay, well,
I guess what we're to assume is that this thing is a mini transporter,
It must be. That's all we can.
To which, you know, begs the question, it makes Data sacrifice not needed. Because we've seen, and I'll explain why. We've seen phasers auto-programmed before, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Why can't they should have more than one of those devices, I would hope. I don't remember what the plot is. Maybe that's the only one. But, you know, you think if you make another one of those, Data sets the phaser to fire 2 seconds after they leave. They beam out, everybody's fine.
Or, oh, I hate that I'm going to do this. Or, he attaches the device to Picard, shoots out a window, programs the phaser, and jumps.
Either that, or programs the phaser, gives the thing to Picard, hugs Picard, because they're all close,
yeah.
And then, you know...
And the two of them beam out together.
Right. Even if it only would have transported Picard, Data could have gotten back to the Enterprise the way he got over to Shinzon ship.
Yeah, he doesn't need air. He can survive in the vacuum, as he proved.
To be fair, I mean, we are getting down to the final countdown at that point. He might
exploded and he, you know, wouldn't have been destroyed in the explosion. He would have been launched.
But my point still stands. Even if you are with 15 seconds left and can't get to the breach in the hull, hug Picard. Program the phaser, hug Picard, get out of there.
Well, he doesn't, and the ship blows up. Picard gets back over to the ship, and there's a touching moment there when, you know, they realize that Picard made it back, but Data didn't. And
Fuck, it's nearly been 3 hours now.
And the next scene is them all standing around in Picard's ready room, just like the deleted scene which we missed, where Picard and Data were drinking the Chateau Picard. Except, I don't know. I see you had this listed as one of the clips, Matt, and I did even pull it, but all that really happens in this scene is Picard saying...
Yeah, I should have made this optional. I should have... just never mind.
He says...
To absent friends.
Which also is the same toast that Kirk made in Star Trek III.
Yes. But unlike Star Trek III, there's... Because this could have been so easily avoided, there's no emotional impact. I mean... Yeah. Spock had to die because in his logical mind, he said to himself, only a Vulcan could survive long enough to do what we had to do to get out of there in Star Trek II. So it has to be him. I'll give the conceit to Star Trek Into Darkness that we're falling towards the atmosphere and Kirk is right there and he doesn't want to send Scotty. He wants to do this himself. So it has to be Kirk. Doesn't have to be Kirk, but I give it that conceit in that movie.
Yeah. So, the only other big part to this eulogy scene, kind of, is Riker speaking up because everybody's just feeling sad and quiet. And he says, you know, the first time I saw Data, he was leaning against a tree in the holodeck trying to whistle some tune. I can't remember the song. It was Pop Goes the Weasel.
Yes, we all know the song. Yeah. Come on.
And that's that. I mean, you get one more moment when... Actually, it was before that Denatra calls to the Enterprise and Picard says, on screen, and then kind of has a moment, and he's like, just open a channel.
And just open the shuttle bay doors. They don't know the procedures, just, right. I want to get off the bridge.
I mean, that kind of opens relations between the Romulans, so all in all, something good comes from it. Mm. From there, Picard is talking to B4 in the ready room. And he's explaining, and he says, I have a clip. Let's listen.
Well, before you do that, Picard says goodbye to Riker. Another good touching scene, but again, ultimately feels like we're on fast forward at this point to get to the end.
Yeah, I agree. We should have seen a bigger goodbye between Riker and Picard, because this is it. This is their big goodbye. And also, we get to hear about the Titan. That's cool. Oh, sorry, that's it. That's the only mention.
And the other, and again, robbing us of what we needed from this movie. No goodbye for Beverly. No goodbye for Geordi. No goodbye for Worf. Troy just goes with her husband. That's it.
And up next is Picard with B4 in the ready room.
I don't know if all this has made any sense, but I wanted you to know what kind of man he was. In his quest to be more like us, he helped us to see what it means to be human.
My brother was not human.
No, he wasn't. But his wonder, his curiosity about every facet of human nature allowed all of us to see the best parts of ourselves. He evolved. He embraced change because he always wanted to be better than he was.
I do not understand.
Well, I hope someday you will.
Captain, the warp engines are ready to go online.
I'm on my way.
Please inform Commander LaForge.
We'll talk later.
Never saw the sun. Never saw the sun. Never saw the sun.
Shining so bright.
Shining so bright. Never saw things.
Going so right.
Going so right.
Nothing but blue skies.
and then another kind of moment that I see would sully it for a lot of people is Picard walks out. The music changes from this sad kind of rendition of Blue Skies to this triumphant, happy music as Picard walks down a corridor smiling. And you're, you know, and even, you know, in Memory Alpha, it's said, you know, that he sees that though things are changing, things are going to be good. I'm like, if
not really,
if you ended it on a goodbye, don't end it on a happy note. Mm. If this is supposed to be the goodbye, not the things are gonna be okay.
No, but just think of I look, Gino. I get that you don't like the Peter Pan thing, but think about Captain Kirk's final captain's log in Star Trek VI. You know, this is the final voyage of the crew of Enterprise under my command. And to the next generation, we commit our prosperity and our future, and they'll continue our voyages and go boldly where no one has gone before. Hmm. Perfect ending for the original series. Like, it wraps up the poignancy. It makes me cry in a good way. Like, it
rolls
on
the red carpet for TNG.
Yeah,
and not, it does that, but it reminds me why I loved these characters in the original series, and it felt like it gives you a real sense of like they won at life. That's what that ending reminds me of. This ending, I walk out of Nemesis feeling like I'm walking out of a wake. Like, it's that depressing. And it's just, it's not the ending I wanted for these characters. TNG was my series. It was my series. And these were my characters. Yeah. These were my childhood heroes. And this is how it's over. And it breaks my heart that even though I want the movies to stay with JJ and the JJ verse, it breaks, part of me is sad that TNG will never get the closure that I wanted them to have. Because this isn't it. I'm sorry, it's not.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely not. And I'll agree with you there. But that's the movie.
That's the movie. That's, and
this may not be the movie we wanted, but it's the movie we got.
I suppose. But Mark, I know you have to go, and I know I'm going to get you in trouble with your wife here. So why don't you go first as our guest? Why don't you give us your final thoughts and readings on Star Trek Nemesis?
Okay, so like I said, I saw this a number of years after it was first released, and I knew about the death of Data. And as you said, Matt, I grew up with TNG. I was a teenager. I watched it on TV. I grew up with these characters. I had a huge investment in them. And I cared about what happened to them. And this movie comes along, and the characters behave very differently. I don't like the way Deanna is only there, as you said, her only purpose in this movie is to be mind-raped by Shinzon, which is just disgusting. They kill off Data, and I'm still very much upset about that. I know that they say you can come back, but the whole fact that they're cheapening Data's journey to humanity that he went through all of the way through TNG to say, oh, well, he's just like a USB stick. We can just transfer his mind into this other body, and he can carry on. That doesn't sit well with me. Shinzon, I don't understand why he's there as a bad guy. I don't understand what he wants. Okay, he says he's suffered at the hands of the Romulans and just wants to take over the galaxy. I don't buy it. I do like the effects in the movie, though, Gino, you're right. I mean, this is as good as some of the effects ever get, and the ships are really cool, the props are really nice. But overall, I walk out of this and I'm disappointed, and I'm sad that this is the end of TNG. And I can probably only give this... I've struggled with the score. I have. I'm going to give this 2 stars. 2.5 would be average, but this is below average for me. It's nowhere near Star Trek V bad. To quote the Big Bang Theory, Star Trek V is the measure by which all badness is judged. But for me, it's probably the second worst Star Trek movie. I can't give it any more than a 2, I'm afraid.
Gino, I'm interested to hear your final analysis of this movie, because I have a feeling that you thought I was going to come in here and be antagonistic with you, and I feel like even though we don't necessarily agree with each other, I feel like we had a really nice, engaging, civil discussion about our perspectives.
Here's the thing. It was a lot of the lead up to our review of Nemesis was that we were just going to argue the whole time, and this was just going to turn into a know you're wrong fest. But when it comes down to it, I think we spent enough time analyzing the Star Trek franchise as a whole by the sum of its parts. We can logically break down an episode and explain to each other why we see it the way we do. That being said, Star Trek Nemesis is still my favorite movie. And I'm appealed by visual splendor, and the Next Generation crew will always be my favorite. I don't think I look at this movie in a linear fashion. You know, when you look at other Next Generation episodes, things are episodic. And maybe it just doesn't feel enough like a movie to me to be able to hold it in such high regard. You know, to me it feels like they're going to be here next week, and Data didn't really die. So, I don't know. It feels like nothing changed, and that's why I don't feel as much let down. But if you look at it as the last Next Generation episode ever, there's no goodbye, and we're just kind of left wanting. But the movie is, to me, very entertaining, and I think they used the characters well. They could have done it better. Knowing how things are put together, they sadly made a poor choice in directing, and that's that. You need somebody who's going to appreciate the canon of the Star Trek franchise doing the final movie, and they failed. And Brent Spiner couldn't do enough to hold it, and John Logan, apparently as a very involved Star Trek fan, just couldn't give it the splendor that it deserved. And I like to look at this episode as what it could have been and its potential, but that's not really fair if I'm going to rate other episodes by just what I've seen and not what it could have been. I mean, maybe I can go back to Voyager episodes and see what they were originally written as, and I might love the Voyager episode Nemesis, ironically enough. But for some reason, I just love this movie. It just speaks to me in an interesting way, and it's pretty, and I love the Enterprise E, and I love seeing ships smash into each other, and the Romulans are always very cool to see. And I mean, you can't say anything bad about the actors. They act and they do it well, and they've been playing these parts for so long, they know what they're doing. But I don't think I can give it a perfect score. Even though it's my favorite Star Trek movie, I'm only going to give it 4 stars.
I'm surprised, because I would have thought for sure, like, the personal love of it would have pushed it up to that 5.
You would think so, you know, and if we were just rating by entertainment value, sure, it's a 5. I'm entertained, but that's not it, and your wonderful points are great. There are gigantic plot holes in this movie. There are plot chasms in this movie, and things we have to ignore, and there are MacGuffins throughout all of Star Trek, but there comes a point when it's not something you can just write off so easily. And the best answer I can give you is, well, you know, maybe this or maybe that. But there are some things that you cannot explain with how things came together the way they did in this movie. And right. I'm not going to deny that. It's not a perfect movie. I love it. It's an ugly dog.
It's like that member of the family that's the outcast. No one wants to talk to him, but you still talk to him because he's family.
Yeah, they're still going to be there Thanksgiving, and still going to have to eat right next to him.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, kids, if you don't know him, it's you.
And what I want to get across to the listeners is this. I kind of joked at the beginning that the Snark would be on and it would be an epic battle between me and Gino, but...
He was Tony Snark in this episode.
Tony Snark.
I'm sorry.
Wow. That might be a pun worthy of this movie. But what I hope that listeners got out of this was that I was not trying to take away Gino's enjoyment of this movie, because he's a Star Trek fan as much as I'm a Star Trek fan, and he's free to like whatever Star Trek he wants. And so same goes for everybody. And I have some controversial opinions out there, too. I mean, the fact that Star Trek Into Darkness is my favorite Star Trek film is going to make me a pariah amongst most people. And I get that. I get that also saying that I like Star Trek III better than Star Trek II equally makes me a pariah amongst people. And that's fine. But what I hope that listeners got out of this was that I was not trying to take away anything from Gino. And I hope, I certainly know he didn't feel that way at all.
No, I don't. And I really feel like this was an even conversation. So right. I don't feel beat up on at all.
Right. That being said, I mean... I don't want to beat a dead horse, because I think I outlined pretty clearly why this movie just doesn't work for me. And the reason that I'm going to give the score that I give it is because, yes, it's better than 5, as Mark said, but it just leaves me sad. Like, I'm really, really sad when I watch this movie, because, like I said, this was my Star Trek. Next Generation was my Star Trek. And I wanted so badly... Star Trek VI is my favorite original series movie. Next Generation deserved a Star Trek VI for its last film. And I wanted the closure. I wanted to go on the ride and remind myself of why these characters were so beloved for 15 years at that point in time in 2002. And characters are acting out of character. The story doesn't make sense. Deanna Troi is there to get raped, which, you know, is a plot point among many, but it really killed me in the middle. Like, halfway through this movie, I was done. Like, I'm serious. It's past the point of no return, and I think that people who want to criticize Star Trek Into Darkness for being misogynistic because there's a shot of Alice Eve in their underwear, where were you in 2002? Because I can assure you, this is far worse than a couple of glorified shots of a girl in her underwear. I mean, this is ugly. The other stuff is just, you know, mindlessly titillating for some people. And that's fine. Star Trek has always been that. But the way it's handled is just poor. It's poor. And thank God that when they decided to reboot the franchise, thank God they didn't get someone who, even though he wasn't a fan of Star Trek, wasn't ambivalent, just pure and pure ambivalent toward the whole thing. You could tell Star Trek 2009 might be a Hollywood production. Yes, it might be flashy. Yes, there might be action. But I see passion in there. I see some love for the franchise. I see characters acting the way that they should. You know, I see the love that the people had toward making that a good Star Trek movie. So thank God that we got someone like that when the series came back. Because if it had continued with another ambivalence, There wouldn't be any more Star Trek movies, in my opinion. You can't work on a project when you're totally ambivalent toward the source material. And you know what? If you are, it's going to show in the final product. So with that being said, it's better than 5, so I'm going to give it more than a 1 star. I think I gave 5 like a 0.25. But I can't even get it toward 2 stars, because... while it's watchable and it's entertaining, just the feeling that it gives me and what it does to these characters I love just makes me sad. Makes me very, very sad. And so I'm going to give this a 1.75. Welcome to our final feedback section for our movie shows. Actually, second to last, but it's on the final movie show that we're doing. We're going to read the feedback that we had gotten a couple months ago from our show on Star Trek Insurrection.
Was it months?
Yeah, it was months.
Wow.
It was back in November, because we didn't do one for December.
Okay. All right.
But the first comment we have here is from Captain Proton, Ben. It was his first movie special where he was no longer a permanent member of the Delta Quadrant, so he got to leave us feedback for this one. And he said, "Nice review, guys and gal. I didn't hate the audio quality, and to time travel a bit, I liked the new opening." And
I'm for those stop of you right who, there, yeah, go ahead.
For those of you who don't remember, this was the disaster show where we had to record on Skype.
Oh, it was terrible. I'm glad it turned out as good as it did, but that took a lot of production. So be glad you got what you got.
It was really trying to make something, you know, gold out of a pile of crap. And that's not to say that Larry Nemechek was crap, because he was good. It was the problem with everything else, all the technical difficulties and time schedules. But continuing, he says, "Matt, they mentioned DS9 when John Luck Picker was given orders to throw wooden sabots into the machinery. No need to get all Dominion here. Cisco has it handled." And he's responding to my criticism of the fact that Insurrection should have had some Dominion War tie-in, being a quadrant-wide war. But apparently he thinks Cisco got it handled, even though the Federation's losing. So,
Not to mention the squadron of Jem'Hadar ships that are somehow lost in the wormhole.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't think he's got it handled, so I'm going to say no to that. But good point, I guess. Gino, weren't you there for the episode Nemesis where Chakotay realizes that just because you are pretty doesn't make you good? In Trek, I do not suspect evil because you are ugly, only if you have more than 4 pips on your collar.
A lot of what we've seen in Trek shows us the uglier you are, the worse you are. And this was a unique situation. It was a movie. You got to look at it like a movie. I'm going to say that.
Right. And he just says, "Mel, way to stand up to those brutes, peace and long life." If you want to call standing up to us being the only holdout for liking Insurrection when the 3 of us gave it mediocre reviews, I guess you could call it that.
And I watched Alien vs. Predator, both 1 and 2
oh,
today.
Oh, God, why?
Just for fun. And that mention
that is
of
no
the
fun.
Episode Nemesis is just, oh, what a ripoff of the Predator. Oh, man.
The bigger question is, why would you watch those movies for fun? There is no fun to be had in either of those movies.
You know, I thought back-to-back would be nice, because the second one starts exactly at the end of the first one, but...
And manages to somehow be worse.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Okay, so, Professor Sub-Zero has a note and says, "Well done, everybody. This was a very strong episode, and the sound quality wasn't all that distracting. Thanks, Professor, I worked hard." Anyway, he says the guests were good, and it goes without saying Larry Nemechek was particularly fantastic. Of course he is. Jump on any chance to have him back. We absolutely will. And like you'll have noticed in this episode, we had a little... I had an interview with him beforehand, which was cool. Anyway, he says, "I think this movie tried to hit the right mix of what a Trek movie should be. A good thought-provoking drama that drives the story and then punctuate it with some action that doesn't distract from the core. You don't have to sacrifice either element to still appeal to hardcore fans in the mainstream. First Contact and Khan accomplished that. Insurrection was hitting the right ratio, but the failing of the movie was that the thought-provoking drama just ended up being boring, so we became disinterested in the action. They had to create aliens from scratch, and it is hard to invest much emotion in them when they only get a fraction of screen time, having to share it with the ensemble cast. As brought up by Mr. Nemechek, I'd have to imagine some established aliens like the Romulans would have helped immeasurably. At least we'd have a villain we hate rather than the ones that we're sort of apathetic about. Speaking of apathy, that is the big issue with this movie. It doesn't just hit the viewer in any great way, for me at least. Each time I watch it, I'm left with no strong opinion any direction. 2 stars. Matt has set his targets on me for being a JJ Trek hater, so I will try to classify. I will never say those movies are bad.
And I will refute every point.
He says, far from it. They are very entertaining movies. Why, yes, you are correct, Professor. Good action, funny, likable actors, etc. I'm sure people have made this argument time and again, but I don't think they're a great Star Trek movie.
That's wrong.
That ratio I mentioned above is flipped in these movies. They are primarily driven by action, and it seems rather relentless. They only have some cursory elements that make you think. Kirk struggles with firing those missiles at Khan for about 3 minutes? No time for ethical dilemmas. We've gone 2 script pages without a battle.
And actually,
this is my fundamental...
Well, I'll pause there. Actually, if you bother to watch the movie again, there are much more pauses in between action scenes. So let's not exaggerate too much, shall we?
Right. He says, this is my fundamental issue with it. While irritating, I can look past them, ditching the 40 years of continuity, breweries in space, and crap like walking on the walls of the
ship.
All
the stuff I advise you to get over.
What I can't get over is them getting rid of the element that has made Trek endure, challenging the viewer and making them think.
Oh, gee, well, I was challenged. Does that mean that I'm, like, not a good Trek person anymore?
Don't give Professor Sub-Zero an opportunity to call you challenged.
Oh, please. You know what? We appreciate the feedback, but let's see. Ditching 40 years of continuity, well, boo-hoo, so sad. And they really didn't. It's just another timeline. Breweries in space, Crimea River.
Crap, and like we had a long discussion about the inertial dampeners going off and
walking on the walls of the ships. Sorry to break it to you, but it's a movie. Why do we need a wormhole sequence in the middle of Star Trek The Motion Picture that serves nothing and does nothing? So, again, cry me a river.
Professor, you got to come on sometime and voice your opinions in real time because you're going to get slapped down like this. Anyway, he finishes up by saying, so I'd rather watch Insurrection try and fail than in Into Darkness succeed. Succeed, he says. I'm sorry. Obviously, I appreciate that isn't what movie makers want to make anymore. They want summer and holiday blockbusters, and they just view Trek as an exploitable franchise with name recognition. Ultimately, Trek is probably best suited for the TV medium. So much for me writing shorter feedback. Feel no obligation to read this all on the show. I tend to ramble. Well, now that I got to the end of your feedback and saw that, maybe I'll just cut that out.
And no, one more editing. Thing. Whatever. If you honestly think that Star Trek The Motion Picture, or really any of those Star Trek movies, were made out of love for the franchise and not because they wanted to make a buck, yeah, you got another thing coming. Sorry. It's a rude wake-up call, but it's true. The only reason the motion picture was made is because they wanted to. They saw that Star Wars money and thought they could cash in on that.
Yep.
So don't act like this is some sort of like beloved, made with love all the time, these movie series. Now, they're written well, which is important, but don't act like they're a labor of love. They've all been for profit ventures.
Yes.
Sorry, Trek fans. It hurts to hear the truth sometimes, but that's the truth.
Yeah. When it comes down to it, it's a TV show that they made for money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Man. So, moving right along, though, our next comment here is from Matthias, who says, well, after seeing Star Trek First Contact, I was really excited about the new movie, and I liked it. It wasn't as action-packed as the last movie, but that's not always a bad thing, and the story was about one race trying to get what the brother race had found by accident is interesting. Oh, and who else to bring in some comic relief than Michael Dorn? I liked the way he played Worf. All in all, I didn't like the movie as much as First Contact, but it was one of the better movies, way better than Nemesis anyway, and oh, by the way, the movie I liked least was Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, to which I say, if you think Star Trek III is the worst of the bunch...
Then you haven't seen Star Trek V.
Or the motion
I'm
going to
stop you right there.
Or Nemesis, or...
Nemesis.
Even you admitted I had some good points about it.
You had some great points. It's still my lovable ugly dog.
Yeah, no, I'm not taking that away from you, but come on, Star Trek 3. You know what, I'm going to throw down a gauntlet, Trek fans, and you can come at me if you want because you already know I'm not scared of you. I like 3 better than 2. What do you think of that?
What do you think of that?
It's true.
Well, up next, Jarek has a post that says, great show, guys, and I have to admit that I quite like Insurrection, or at least find it very easy to watch. I wouldn't argue that it has the feel of a bigger budget TV episode, or that the dodgy Admiral plot is overused. Let's not even get into the ridiculous joystick, or what they were thinking getting F. Murray to scream out loud like that. I recall reading the novelization that gave the Admiral a little more depth, but taken as a whole, the movie is a bit of a fluff piece for the franchise. I have to agree with you, Jarek. Yeah.
But, yeah, that's the thing I'll give you as a consolation prize, Gino, is I explained why I didn't really love Shinzon all that much as a villain, but at least he never screamed like a little girl.
Yeah. He had a few gurgly moments, but no screams.
So, yeah, I mean... at the end of the day, I think I like, I didn't say this on the show, but I think Insurrection for me is the better Trek movie. But that being said, it's forgettable is the word that I keep coming back to. It's very, very non-plussing. Anyway, we're going to move on to our next comment from Darren73, who said, another great show. I actually didn't notice any audio problems, so kudos to you, Gino.
Yeah.
Some great background information from Larry and some great one-liners from Matt, Space Amish. Well,
I still love that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Just call this movie from now on Star Trek Space Amish.
Frontier.
The Amish Frontier.
These are the voyages of the covered wagon.
Its ongoing mission to avoid all technology.
To explore strange new hay piles.
To boldly go where no, you know, buckle hat wearing man has gone before. I also found Insurrection boring. It does, however, have a few redeeming scenes. During the British tar scene, it always cracks me up to see Worf pretending to know the song when Picard looks at him. The action scene on the mountain was good and had one of the places where the humor worked. But the overall film was as dull as dishwater. Good analogy.
Excuse me. I've seen some very interesting dishwater.
Yeah, sometimes dishwater can be more interesting than Insurrection, I have to agree.
Yeah, and I liked the British tar scene. It was great.
Yeah, it was fun. It's ironic because people really don't know that much of our thoughts on the on little parts of the movie itself because we didn't get to go through the plot that heavily during the podcast. So people don't know what we thought of the British tar scene and all that sort of stuff. It was okay.
Yeah.
It's certainly not as bad as Blue Skies.
Really?
Yeah, Blue Skies just reeked of Brent Spiner wanting to stoke his own ego.
Okay.
I first saw this movie in an odd way. I mixed up the screening times and went in an hour into the film. No one told me when I bought my ticket, and I proceeded to watch the rest of it having no idea what was going on. I then went to another cinema and watched the first half until I got to the point where I'd first seen it and left, which means I guess you didn't find it that compelling that you wanted to watch the full movie. You just wanted to see what you missed.
Right, you didn't want to stick around. Dang.
I thought that maybe it was because I had seen it in the wrong order that I was disappointed with the film, but when I got it on VHS and watched it again in the normal way, I still was disappointed.
Yep.
As many a Trek fan, I think, were. But thanks for the comment, Darren, and the interesting story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great way to see a movie, half and a half.
And no one stopped him. Like, nope. I guess the high schooler working at the theater that day just didn't give a damn.
Yeah, I don't think that a prerequisite for getting a job at a movie theater includes giving a damn.
Right, exactly.
This from a previous movie theater employee.
You just give them the tickets and the popcorn and you move right the hell along.
Yep. Popcorn, by the way, the bane of our existence.
But I love it so much.
Anyway, a note from Patak Paul, who says, fantastic podcast. I think I've said before I would take the TV episodes over the films any day. Insurrection, or Picard's Erection, is a pretty easy target as it's boring. However, the spirit of TNG is there, probably more so than any other TNG film incarnation.
And you know what? He does have a point. I just wanted to sorry to interrupt you there, but no. I didn't really get to talk about this during the show because, like I said, we were speeding right along. But one of the pluses of Insurrection is that it does have the atmosphere of the TV show and some of the interactions and some of the jokes and some of the humor.
Yeah, there's a definite feel of camaraderie between the crew.
More so than the movies I like better, Generations and First Contact. Those are better movies, but they felt. Which I guess is a plus and a minus, because Generations and more so First Contact felt like movies, while this felt like more of another episode of the TV show, which is good in a sense, but not what you want when you pay $7 for a ticket.
Right. You know, if you want to put it timeline-wise, I kind of want to compare it to Galaxy Quest a little bit, because if you think about Nemesis, they were at the point where the characters in Galaxy Quest were at the start of the movie. Where they're just kind of like, we did this thing 20 years ago, we're now rich for it, but come on, we're just signing autographs and all this stuff. Whereas in Insurrection, you could still tell they were kind of buddies and they were still used to doing stuff together often.
Well, and you know, I think that goes to the fact that Generations and First Contact and Insurrection were made 2 years apart from each other in between, whereas the time between Insurrection and Nemesis is 4 years.
Yeah, there's a definite drought there. Well, by Grafdar's hammer, let's move along. Paul says, it does worry me that the perfect planet has zero racial diversity, and that there was that episode of TNG where Picard essentially does the complete opposite when he wants to move the Indians from the planet.
Which is pointed out in the Red Letter Media reviews of Insurrection. I found that hilarious, actually, yeah. Because he's right. There is that episode where they have to move the Native Americans from the planet because of the treaty, and Picard doesn't blink an eyelash because he's just following orders at that point.
Let us never forget, that's the episode where Wesley Crusher leaves with the Traveler and no one has any qualms about it.
It's a really bad episode. I can't stand that episode.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, says Larry was a great addition to tell us what could have been. This all being said, when I was younger, I watched this lots of times because as a kid, you do not know the difference between good and bad. It's only since becoming a podcaster that I look at these films/episodes with such a critical eye. The perfect way to watch this film is when you feel just slightly under the weather, on the sofa with a bed cover, pot of coffee at your side with a bag of cheap corner shop sweets. Paul, I think you nailed it.
Might I add, I think it's one of those movies where it's better if, unless you're reviewing this for a podcast and have to watch it and be critical of it, if you can do other things while watching it and just have it on in the back, it's not so bad.
See, that's what I kind of do with Star Trek VI. I'll just turn it on, pass out for a while, wake up for a little bit of it, pass out for a while, Star Trek VI.
Wait, Star Trek VI?
Star Trek VI. It's my pass-out movie.
I am going to, like, hurt you.
Come through this computer. Come on.
You do that to a bad Star Trek movie. You do that. If anything, one should be everybody's pass-out movie, because you could pass out in the middle of that and nothing happens.
Well, yeah, nothing does happen, but it's pretty funky. You gotta admire it for that. It has a very 2001 A Space Odyssey feel with the uniforms and whatnot.
Well, because I don't normally drop acid when I watch Star Trek the Motion Picture, it really doesn't do anything for me.
Whoa, she's bald!
Can you imagine, by the way, I know this is so un-PC of us, but like, can you imagine what it would be like watching the wormhole scene high?
Oh, dude.
With all the colors and stuff and the tripping
voices. That's
all you
really have to say about it. Oh, dude. Wait, turn the lights off. Rewind it.
By the way, this is how you can tell listeners that Melissa's not here with us, is because Gino and I are talking about dropping acid to Star Trek.
I can't even get a woohoo out of him, so... Okay, let's move on.
All right, our final comment comes from someone who I don't think drops any acid, and that would be Medic 1849, a.k.a.
It's
Blair.
It's illegal in Canada.
Well, it's illegal here. That doesn't stop us. But anyway, he says, another great movie retrospective, guys. I remember going into this movie knowing that it would have a hard act to follow after the success of First Contact. I don't mind the movie, although the pace is so slow. However, I think I hold the movie higher than it should be because Nemesis was so bad.
Boo!
That movie did have some good moments, and I can rewatch this movie more often than Nemesis, and there
Boo!
I must agree. I must agree. I know they wanted to tame things down a little after First Contact, but looking back, I think they should have seized the opportunity to show the Enterprise-E crew what the Enterprise-E crew was doing to play their part in the Dominion War. Yes, that absolutely should have been the movie. I understand some may have been tired from this arc being played out in DS9. Who? The insane people, maybe. However, so many fans wonder how Picard et al. Handled the war and the action they saw. As indicated in the podcast, I find it hard to believe that the flagship of Starfleet wouldn't be on the front line with all those losses that Starfleet was suffering. The senior crew wouldn't be forced to be split up to provide experience on other ships. Great to hear Larry's behind-the-scenes stories. I hope you can have him on again. Your next movie retrospective should be... interesting. Well, you now know whether it was interesting or not, so you can let us know.
Temporal mechanics!
And, Gino, if they want to let us know whether it was interesting or not, how could they do that?
You can let us know how interesting or disinteresting or slightly interesting or moderately interesting you might think we actually are in some form. In many ways. One, you can go to iTunes and leave us 5-star reviews because, come on, Trekkies, you got to give us a little bit of love. You can also go to trekradio.net at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays. Because, well, if you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, there's always TrekRadio.net. But where else can they go, Matt?
They can also talk to us through our email at deltaquadrantpodcast@gmail.com, our weekly forum threads at forum.trekmatefamily.com. Tweet us. We are at Delta Quadrant Cast, QADT_cast on Twitter. And you can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheDeltaQuadrant. And please, if you want to take me on and like, because I know I'm pissing people off with my Into Darkness views, and I know I'm pissing people off by how abrasive I am. So I come at me, bros. Like,
sweep the leg.
Sweep the leg. Sweep the leg. I feel it. You know, I this is such a horrible analogy, but just like I feel like one of those Southern militiamen. Just like I got guns and my own fort set up. So like, come after me, Trekkie.
Yes, Matt is the Yosemite Sam mudflap of the podcast world.
Yosemite Sam, but Yosemite Sam always loses. I feel like I need to be someone who always wins.
Okay, I don't know. Will Smith and iRobot?
That's your best analogy?
I don't even know. Let's just go.
Yeah, how many connection problems are you suffering at this point?
At least a bottle.
All right, we're out of here. Well, so we'll do your next movie feedback when we do Voyager's Dark Frontier, because that's
yes!
a movie. So, Mark, I want to thank you for sticking with us through this very long podcast on a movie that you don't necessarily care for.
Thanks for putting up with us. And
it's been my pleasure, as always.
Now, where can people find you on the internets?
Oh, I'm sure everyone knows by now, but best place to find me is on Twitter, so you can follow me. I am at Mark Stamper on Twitter. That's Mark with a C, S-T-A-M-P-E-R. So pop along, give me a follow, tell me you heard me on the Delta Quadrant, and I'll follow you right back.
Thank you, Mark, for joining us again. It was an absolute pleasure getting to talk about these movies with you, and we hope to have you on again for Voyager episodes.
Oh, I'm sure I'll be back very soon.
But until that time, this is us closing the movie retrospective series. We have done it. If you want to listen to our thoughts on previous movies, all you have to do is go and download them. But until next time, this is Matt in Arizona closing Hailing Frequencies.
This is Gino in Oklahoma. See you on the other side.
This is Mark in England saying, I really do wish that movie was so much better. I really do. I'm so disappointed. I'm sorry. I love you, TNG. I'm sorry.
Thanks for listening to the Delta Quadrant. Please join us again next week. Star Trek Voyager and the Voyager theme song are the property of CBS Television Studios, and no infringement is intended.
You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.